Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio.
Everybody out there, I love everybody, and I hope you like the song. Al Green, my man. I'm still a 60s man. I like the 60s. They were the best times of my life. But now it's 2014, and I want to tell you, it's still good. Because I'm still in love with you. That's what Al Green says. That's what I say. So here we are. How do we transition from being in love with you, being in love with everybody, to where we are today in a bright, sunny, beautiful day in North Kakalaki, North Carolina? We have places in North Carolina, which we're going to talk about a little bit later in the show. It might as well be Guantanamo Bay. They put people in prison, in jail, I should say, in jail, and don't give them their rights. They hold everything away. They don't give them their six. They violate due process, Sixth Amendment, 14th Amendment. Because people do not protest. You can't let people step on you and not say anything. Because it's been done your whole life. Get off your butts and do something about it. We got a lawless sheriff and a lawless DA in Franklin County. Definitely the assistant DA is the one that's lawless. I mean, and if the DA don't know what's going on, he's in charge of the sinking ship. Because this ship is about to sink. They are about to get a bunch of major pressure. We'll talk about that a little bit later. We have on our show today, we have Mr. Ty Turner, who is running for District 40. And we have Representative Marcus Brandon, who is running for the U.S. Congressional District 12 that was vacated by Mel Watt when Mel Watt was nominated and is now in the cabinet of the president. I've only met Marcus Brandon only once, so I am not. And he might be familiar with me, but he was very, very active in a lot of things in the, Greensboro area. And he will be with us also. So we will have a lot of things to talk about with Marcus Brandon. There's a few other people that will be calling in, and we will make sure that you hear from them. Now, there's a lot of things that has been going on, a lot of things that are going on. We got people who want to impeach the president. You know, if you're out there and you go along with every single thing that's said on Fox News, you are a complete moron. You just can't set up, he looked at us wrong. Let's impeach him. Every single thing this constitutional lawyer has done has been within the Constitution. This has been the first time we've had a constitutional lawyer in the White House. Dick Cheney was not a constitutional lawyer. He was a college dropout. And a draft dodger. George Bush was not a constitutional lawyer. That's why they were able, they thought, that they could trample on the Constitution by getting us into two wars. And by selling us goods about the Medicare and putting in D, which only was a giveaway to the prescription drug companies. And they're saying right now that the president wants to take, again, that's what got Larry Kissel down here from the 8th Congressional District in trouble. That's why he's no longer the 8th Congressional District representative from North Carolina, because he was saying the same. The president took $750 million out of Medicare to create the ACA, which we have now. They're complete liars. The $750 million that he took out of Medicare was going to the drug companies. Why should they get paid additional monies when they're already charging us exorbitant fees? And I talk about this all the time. I have a medication called Dexilant. It's better, far better than Nexium. I take it once a day. that has relieved my symptoms, almost 95% relief. When I got the prescription from my doctor, I took it to the insurance company, and the insurance company, not the insurance company, to the drug company, and they said it's going to be $173 for 30 capsules. Then they told me my insurance company does not allow or pay for this medication now. So it would have cost me $173. So I said, forget it. So I went to the mail-in drug company, Medco, which is now eScripts, I believe. I got a 90-day supply. A 90-day supply. That means 90 capsules for, I believe, less than $70. Now, tell me the hell is going on here. And then they need additional monies on top of the scam that they're running on everyday people now. These prescription drug cartels, which that's all they are, they should be challenged by the Attorney General for the RICO law because they are absolutely racketeers. The drug companies are actually racketeers. And you can find anything. How can you go to a mail company and get $100 off a prescription? Kidding me? Is there something wrong with this picture? So that's what the president was trying to do. And when Paul, let me see, do I have this here? Let's see. I'm looking on here. I'm looking on here. Just hold on a minute, ladies and gentlemen. Paul Ryan, when he went to talk about his new idea of how things should go, he presented, I don't even have this thing to play. And I'm looking for it, and I can't find it. But anyway, Paul Ryan presented his budget. And his budget still included the $750 million that the president said, that they said the president had in his budget. Now, how can he go both ways? How can he say the president is taking $750 million out of the Medicare budget when he's doing the same thing in his budget? People, you got to listen. You have to listen to what is said. I want you to hear a little bit else what Paul Ryan said.
House Budget Committee Chairman Paul Ryan, I don't think there's a real problem with the work of men in the city. Ryan appeared on Bill Bennett's Morning America radio show on Wednesday, and this to say when Bennett asked her about children needing to see their parents at work, they go,
we have got this tailspin of culture in our inner cities in particular of men not working and just generations of men not even thinking about working or learning the value and the culture of work. And so there's a real culture problem here that has to be dealt with.
Ryan added that people outside of these communities need to get involved as well.
So this is what we talk about when we talk about civil society. If you're driving from the suburb, you know, to the sports arena downtown by these blighted neighborhoods, you can't just say, I'm paying my taxes, government's going to fix that. You need to get involved. You need to get involved yourself, whether through a good mentor program or some religious charity, whatever it is, to make a difference. And that's how we help resuscitate our culture.
California Representative Barbara Lee, a Democrat, criticized Ryan's comments, saying, my colleague Congressman Ryan's comments about inner-city poverty are a thinly veiled racial attack and can't be tolerated. Let's be clear. When Mr. Ryan says inner city, when he says culture, these are simply code words for what he really means, black. At least, I kind of take her point. That is probably what he means. Does that make it racism?
certainly deny that he's saying it has anything to do with race. I think one thing that's important to point out is that, you know, poverty is rising in the suburbs very quickly, more quickly in the past 10 years than it is in the inner city. So when you're talking about poverty, when you're talking about things that people should do to get out and, you know, help their fellow American, you should be talking as well about people in the suburbs. It's not just people in the inner city. So I think it makes sense for people to sort of read that as, why are you talking about just the inner city? Is that some sort of racially coded statement? Only Paul Ryan can really know what he meant, you know, in his heart about race in that statement, whether he meant anything at all. But I think it makes sense to read it that way, and I think that that's really something that he should be a little bit more sensitive to.
Yeah, I mean, the problem is that any time you identify demographic issues that have to that cut along racial lines, it becomes almost impossible to talk about, right? But if you put those same words in the mouth of Bill Cosby, this is something that Bill Cosby has said a bazillion times. This is something that some black leaders have said many, many times about the importance of young black men in inner cities to take responsibility and make sure that they're focusing on getting jobs and taking care of their families. Is it just something that a person who is Paul Ryan simply by virtue of the fact that he's Paul Ryan can't say?
No, I think that that's part of it. I think people are more sensitive to statements like this from Republicans just because of the policies that come along with it. So you do. You have people like Obama who are urging fathers, you know, in African-American communities especially, to stay involved in their kids' lives, to set a good example for them. And that's not something that, you know, people find offensive or find to be some sort of dog whistle. When you have people like Paul Ryan who are advocating these sort of welfare cuts and saying that it's because, you know, essentially people in the inner cities are lazy and don't want to work, that's when it becomes offensive, and that's when people start to, you know, feel that it's something that's inappropriate.
Okay. The man's lunacy. He misspoke, right? This is what he's saying now. He misspoke when he said what he said about inner cities. Let me give you a few statistics, cities. Just a few. Poverty in the United States, non-metropolitan areas in the United States, are 17.7% in poverty. Non-metropolitan areas. That means the rural areas. That means Appalachia. That means Franklin County, North Carolina. That means Anson, North Carolina. Rural. Maybe not Anson, but definitely Franklin. Metropolitan areas are only 14.5% in poverty. Now, how can you say inner city? Now, what the heck is that? Every Tom, Dick, and Harry who has half a brain know that means black. Every Tom, Dick, and Harry knows that. So why isn't he looking rural areas? But you know why? He was from a rural area. That's why. That's where he grew up at. A man grew up receiving Social Security checks because his father died at 55. He got them till he was 18 years of age, but yet he wants to kill your Social Security. And this is the problem we have with all these mongrel, moron, conservative neocons. They don't care about you. All they care about is getting what they need. We want it. We got it. You get it because we ain't giving it to you. Non-metropolitan areas? What the hell does that mean? That don't mean Harlem. That don't mean Los Angeles. What does it mean? It means the suburbs. 17.7% of the people not living in a big city are on the poverty level. But he's only referring to inner city because in a car and drove by and saw a slum. Why don't you go up in the daggone hills of Appalachia and see the daggone tents? Why don't you drive down in Franklin County, that's Republican controlled, and see the garbage, the daggone trailers working out of well pumps when you have one store in the town? That's poverty, where families don't have food and have to stretch it. That's going on in non-metropolitan areas. That's going on in the suburbs every single day. Every day. And then he wants to refer to only the inner city. The inner city that they are taking back from any minorities that live there, because it's closer to the city. So what do? In these inner cities, they let them decay. They let them go and become slums, where the people there can't even live in them anymore. Who knows where they go when you have these abandoned buildings and the abandoned factories? And then some rich developer comes in, clears out the property, builds condominiums for $3,000 a month. Oh, don't worry. We'll have some of the poor or middle class come back and live here. Sure. You're middle class. You can afford $3,000 a month for a two-room apartment. Oh, by the way, see, in New York City, you can go anywhere, any time of the day or night, because we have public transportation that travels across the entire city and all the boroughs, five of them, 24/7. That's not an inner city, in my estimation. So this is what we have going. This Paul Ryan neglected to say that there's a total of 8.5 million people living in poverty in non-metropolitan areas. 8.5 million people. 17.7%. Then the government, this is what his response was. We have not built barriers to work. In the House, they have not passed one jobs plan. Not one jobs plan when this president, Barack Obama, became the head of the United States. Not one jobs plan. But they have the gold ring and had 50 votes against the Affordable Care Act that they know won't pass, that they don't, that they, you know, this is like, you know, the definition of insanity when you can say that and can do the same thing over and over and over again and think you're going to get a different result. This is what we have. Ryan also said that his, now, oh, let me tell you this. In his district where he lives, this is Paul Ryan's district, he has 29,420 households that received SNAP benefits from 2009 to 2011. 29,000 households. So we're not talking about 29,000 people. You could have five, four people in every household. And in his district, 53% are working. 53% are working. Listen to this. 77% are white. You hear that? 77% are white. Not African-American. Not Asian-American. Not Indian-American. White American. Ryan's budget cuts would cut $3.3 trillion 10 years from low-income programs. SNAP gone. Kindergarten gone. Programs to feed the kids while they're in school, gone. He wants to give out of those trillions because, hey, what are you going to do with those trillions? Oh, I know what we can do. We can give them to the rich. $394,000 in tax breaks to all those making over $1 million. It's just like when I go, we went to Mexico last year. I bought back 5 bottles. I didn't know I could have bought back 10 because of each of us. Bought back 5 bottles of great tequila. What would someone do by bringing me a bottle of tequila? Another bottle. Yeah, I bought you a bottle of tequila. Oh, really? Put it on the shelf with the other 5 bottles. What's the point? The rich are not going to use it and put it into the economy. They're going to put it in their bank account so the money doesn't get sent back into society and help bring forth jobs. But he's going to kill. He wants to kill all the benefits of those 29,420 households that he represents, and they are white. And you know the reason why he wants to do that? Because he can't do it without cutting into minorities. Because he can't just cut minorities and give the others. Because our poor in this country are represented by white, not minorities. And I want to tell you nothing about the percentage bull. There are more of them than us. And 70% are white from Paul Ryan's district. Now, we have a caller on the line here. Let's see who this is. Oh, who's this?
Hi, this is Mary Neal. I'm enjoying your conversation today, and I just want to thank you for speaking so plainly about the economic situation and how some people will do whatever is necessary, even damage Caucasians to make sure that they damage people of color. I am the Director of Assistance to the Incarcerated Mentally Ill, and also the Human Rights for Prisoners March. And I was told that Shannon Nairobi's mom would be on this show today.
She will be, probably at the 4:30 hour. We're going to have
Excuse
me?
All right, sir. You captured my attention already. So we'll just hang in here and I'll hear the rest of what you're saying now, because you certainly
I'd like to hear some of your thoughts of what I just said.
Well, you know, I'm a prisoner activist, and
yes.
Primarily that's what I do. I expose and oppose oppression against prisoners and against potential prisoners. I was a little bit disturbed to just read some writings by Ms. Ada Wells, Ada B. Wells. And it was very disturbing to see that the conditions that she was writing about in 1893 match what I write about in 2014. She said that Alabama, Arkansas, Florida, Georgia, Kentucky, Louisiana, Mississippi, Nebraska, North Carolina, South Carolina, Tennessee, and Washington claim to be too poor to maintain state convicts within prison walls. Hence, the convicts are leased out to work for railway contractors, mining companies, and those who farm large plantations. It is argued that it would cost large sums of money to build penitentiaries in which to confine and work the prisoners, as is done in northern states, while the lease system, you know, they're leasing slaves, they're leasing prisoners. The lease system brings the state a revenue and relieves it of the cost of building and maintaining prisons. In fact, that the convicts' labor is in this way brought into direct competition with free labor, and that does not seem to be taken into account. The contractors who get these laborers for 30 or 40 cents per day can drive out of the market the men who employ free laborers at a dollar per day. So, you know, it's the same thing as I write about now, how they have the prisoners in jail and how they're always looking for fresh commodities, and it really doesn't matter about guilt or innocence to them because it's just a business enterprise, and any business enterprise is always looking for, and that were using people to, you know, do all of this manning and lay railroad tracks and everything. That's how it's always been with the prison system.
Oh, absolutely.
Go ahead,
absolutely.
Sir.
And, you know, I would like you to send me some information on that, and I'll give you my email address.
All right. Thank you. I just closed up my computer. Let me open it, and I'm sure everybody...
Do you have my email address?
I've been advertising your show quite a good deal, and I just wanted you to know that when I opened my computer for your show, it didn't show as you had a show on live, and no, it did not. And what I had to do to get today's show is I had to go to your last show, which was March 7th, I opened it and I got the phone number. And when I got the phone number, thank you, I was able to get on the air with you. But as far as hearing it on the computer, that link that should work because it brings me to your Blog Talk Radio page, it did not work for me. So I just wanted you to know that because a lot of times when people are being censored, they don't know it themselves.
So you know that if you're using, see, sometimes it's the browser because Explorer does not work. It only works once in a while. So you need to use Chrome or Firefox.
And I'm using Chrome.
You're using Chrome. And when you went to this station, blogtalkradio.com, you need to type in the TLW, and then the live portion will come up.
Okay. Well, I just wanted you to know that it's not easy, okay? It's not easy to get to your live show. I just want you to know that. And most people's shows, I go right to them.
The last show or this show? Which one are you talking about?
This show. I have not been able to reach it on computer. I was able to reach it because I went to your last show, which was March 7th, and I dialed the number. So what I'm saying is, you know, it's hard to reach your live show on computer. And I have no trouble reaching other people.
Did you go to Blog Talk Radio?
Yes, I went to Blog Talk Radio.
And it still didn't come up?
No, it didn't. Oh. I'm telling you, it's not coming up.
That's very unusual. Let me try myself here while I have you on the line.
Typed in was http://www.blogtalkradio.com. www.blogtalkradio.com. The last word with Michael Lawson. And then when I did that, I knew I was on your page because it has all of your shows lined up every 7 days, and the last one recorded is the 7th of March. So I know I was
right
on your page. And what I'm saying is it should have also had that you have a show going on live right now. It should have said that. And it did not.
I think if you press the live next to the microphone, and then in the search box, if you touch TLW, which I'm doing right now, I will, let's see, it should come up. Let me see here. Live. Okay. I went to searching now. Let's just see here because, hey, we need to know these things. And
well,
I think that.
Sir, I shouldn't have to leave your page to get to your live show.
No, you're right. You're right. You should not.
Okay, so I just wanted you to know there's a problem.
Okay, very good. I will definitely check with them on that. I will definitely check with them on that. Thank you very much. Okay, well, if you're going to hang in there, you hang in there, and we will go to, let's see, let me try this, TLW, and I'm going to put it March 14th, let's see, 2014. Let's see if that comes up here. It's loading, and let's see here. Okay, it came up TLW, and let's see. If I press on that, okay, let's see, following. I don't know, live. Let's see, live. Yeah, it's a little difficult, but I'll find out. I'm glad you told me. I will definitely find out.
Oh, I'm glad I did, too. And again, I don't know whether it's like that every day, or if it's just because of your subject matter today. I've been advertising that Shannon Naimoti's mom would be on the show and that we would be talking about Sixth Amendment rights violations, which that is very prominent now, sir. What they do is arrest people on, you know, charges that they don't expect to have to defend in court. They arrest people on those charges, and then they keep them in jail indefinite periods of time with no intention of ever taking those charges to trial. So that is a really horrible thing, and I was surprised that it was being done.
I want you to hold on if you want to, or you can call back, and I will pick you back up when we have, because we're going to have a roundtable discussion with a few reporters that are going to start doing a major story on this. We're going to have a major blitz on this story. And what is your name? What's your first name?
My name again is Mary, M-A-R-Y, Neal, N-E-A-L. And I'm getting ready to send you a hello email right now because you were going to give us your email address.
Right. What is your name? I want to put it on the board here. Just give me your first name.
My first name is Mary, M-A-R-Y.
Okay, Mary, I am locking you in, and I'm locking in. You can either call back or you can just listen because I have a few more people that we need to get to, but I want to get to you, and I want you to be part of our discussion when we start at 4:30 about the Shannon Naimoti case, and I want you to tell everybody, what you just said about this prison system. The system, because it almost mirrors the Pennsylvania prison system where these judges were sentenced, one of them was sentenced to 28 years for the same crime. So you can just hold on, Mary, okay?
Are you still going to give me your email address?
Yes. The email address is M like Mary, A like Anthony, M like Mary, L A W. SON.net.
AGP?
No, ATT, the phone company.
Oh, ATT. Okay.
.net. Okay?
Okay, so I have MAM, ma'am, Lawson at ATT.net.
You got it. Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you, sir. And I was enjoying your conversation on the economic issues also, learning a lot. Thank you very much.
Okay. Hold on. Hello. Who's this?
Ty Turner, how are you?
Ty Turner. I'm sorry to get back to you so late, but we had a young lady just on, Mary, who was giving us some information. We're going to have a major roundtable discussion on the Shannon DeMotti case starting at 4:30. And I'm sorry to get to you. I know there's been a couple of times we've been trying to get together. This is, ladies and gentlemen, this is Ty Turner, who is running for District 40. One voice, one district.
Yes,
and
sir.
That, he said, when you're up against an obstacle, meet it face-to-face. That's what you say. And you were born in Southwest Shaw. You know, there aren't many of you left in this city.
You're right. You're definitely right. It just tells you a lot about the how Charlotte has actually evolved, actually. And it's not a lot of people that know Charlotte when it did not have a nightlife, when it shut down at 5 o'clock, you know.
Shut down, right?
Yeah, when we didn't have the epicenter, and actually when we had the Coliseum over on my side of town on Tryon and Tyvola around that area right there. So it's actually changed a lot in a short amount of time. And it's a testament to how resilient this city is, and it also is a testament to how far we have to go. So I'm very proud to represent Charlotte, and I'm also proud for, you know, individuals who moved into this area who made it their home. And the good thing about that is individuals who moved in, they made it their home. They also brought their own ideas, as well as to add them to the New South to make Charlotte one of the up-and-coming cities, and we've all grown together. So it's a melting pot of individuals here. So, you know, there's no place. I've been all over the place. I've been traveled to New York. I've traveled to New Orleans and California and all types of places with business, but it's no place like home. And Charlotte's one of those places, again, like I said before, you can raise your children here as well as, you know, start off a new career. So it's a testament to the resilience as well as how far we've come as a city.
Well, we don't have much time, and I want you to call back week also. What is the reason why you're running? Why do you want this seat, District 40?
Well, one thing about this district itself, and the reason why I'm running per se, is because actually I am proud of this district. I've seen its resilience. Again, I've seen its good times. I've seen its bad times. I've seen the people of this district who actually care about it. We have a lot of growth that is happening in this area with the Blue Line Extension that will be moving, finally connecting UNC Charlotte to the center city, as well as, you know, bringing new businesses to our area. I'm running for this seat because, again, like I said before, I believe in this district. I see the obstacles as well as I see the challenges. I'm not here as an opportunist. I'm not here as a individual who's just seeking an office for fortune or fame. I'm an individual who actually knows the people here. I see the individuals who've lived here for years, who've been in the Hampshire Hills community, the Hidden Valley area, Eastbrook Woods, all the way to Grilltown, all the way to Hidden Valley. Excuse me, I'm sorry about the Hickory Grove. Even from Plaza Midwood to Shamrock. These individuals have vested interest in our district, but right now you have to have an individual who has new bold ideas, and I'm an individual who think outside of the box. I've seen our district grow, and I also see where it's also headed to, and also see that you have to have an individual who's a fighter who actually can talk to, you know, the individuals and actually can have the same views that they have. And again, like I said before, this district has been a district who has had a lot of diversity, but I think there's like the phoenix that rises from, you know, that rises from the fire. You know, it's going to continue to go further. And you have to have that new youth, that new point of view, individual who actually has seen where we've come from and where we have to go. And right now in Raleigh, we can talk about the problems that's going on in Raleigh, and everyone knows what's going on in Raleigh. I think it's four good Democrats, including myself, who are in this race. It's a total of five of us. All of them are great Democrats. They pay their dues. They've done a good job. But you have to have the boots on the ground. I'm the only one that's been the boots on the ground. I've been the individual who has stood up for single mothers, offered health care to individuals who couldn't afford it. I sign individuals up now for Obamacare. I'm an individual who fought for female reproductive health as I was the health center manager of Planned Parenthood, and I also fought for our seniors as well. But a lot of people ask, you know, wherever you come from, haven't heard from you, don't know who you are. But sometimes I've actually been underneath the tutelage and guidance of a lot of individuals who've led underneath Senator Graham, as well as under the OFA, as well as underneath the Fox campaign. But I've always been the one that if you told me to do something, I did it. I didn't do it just to get my name out there for a photo op. Because at the end of the day, the main people who we need to reach are the voiceless, the individuals who don't have the means to actually stand up and make their voices heard. But you hear them every day, and we see them. I'm one of those people that I can get out of my car and walk up and down the plaza and see the young ladies that's, you know, prostituting themselves, as well as transgender individuals who are going through issues, as well as our young men on Milton Road walking down the street with their pants hanging down, just to be able to talk to them, just to let them know, you know, there is hope. You know, I represent the 35 and younger generation.
I don't have much time. I wanted you to just give me talking points that you want to hit. And then we got to leave because I got a room.
That's fine. I'll definitely do that. Two talking points, which I really want to look at the future of our district, the blue line that's coming through, and the need to move from minimum wage to the living wage. Also, we talked last time when I was on the show about the need to expand health care and also different ways to do that. So I have these ideas. I have three bills right now and I'm ready to take to the floor, which I've authored myself as well as individuals I know in Washington, D.C. And we're ready to go to Raleigh. We're ready to be a fresh voice. And I can get knocked down, but I'm going to get back up. So I feel like everyone has a vested interest in our district. And it's a privilege to actually be on your show. And thank you so much for giving me this time to speak.
And call me this weekend. You have my number. So a little more, and I can get a little more information. I want you to send me some more information, okay?
Sure. Also, I'm just letting you know, if you want to check out any more information about me or learn about my campaign as well as my to-do list, and it's a 7-point plan, you can go to www.tyturner.net. That's www.tyturner.net if you want to contribute as well as get involved with the campaign, as well as my contact information is on there as well. And you can check that out as well, Mr. Lawson, okay?
Okay, appreciate it. Thank you, Ty.
Thank you so much. Have a great day, sir.
For District 40. Thank you.
Yes.
We have another call. I got so many calls here. It's unbelievable. Let's see, because so many people didn't give me their numbers. And who am I talking to now? Who's this?
What about Hans Protzeneder?
How are you, Hans?
Thank you, Michael. I'm doing well. How are you?
Fine. I don't have as much time as I thought I was going to have because we got people calling. My board is lit up. It's full. Tell us about you are now going to be the principal of the Entrepreneur High School, which is a public high school, and it's going to be here in Charlotte. No tuition, and it's the first vocational, technical, and business charter high school in Charlotte. Tell us about it.
Yes, correct. As you indicated, we are unique. We are the first one who actually focuses on career readiness, work willing, and college able. In other words, we prepare our young folks to be able to get a job after high school, or if they want, they can also go on to college. And classes taught include automotive, construction, manufacturing, culinary arts, and nursing assistant. And we have an info day tomorrow, if I may say this, tomorrow, Saturday, between 11 and 3 o'clock, at 5431 Hickory Grove Road, a little church building between W.T. Harris and Sean Amity Road.
Okay, and that's going to be, that's an open house, right?
It's an info day. When we talk about our program, when we introduce our management, our board, some of our teachers, and the program itself.
Very good. Well, if they want more information, do they have a number about the high school that people can call into?
Yes. One would be the website, www.goehs, G-O, like in walk, E as in East, H as in Henry, S in Sam, ehs.org, or they can call 704-906-2900.
I want to thank you, Hunt, for everything. You have been in the school system for a long time, and I know that's been your passion. And congratulations for becoming the principal over there. And we're going to talk again. I want some more information next week about what happened on Saturday. And
great.
If I get a chance, I'll be there also. Okay?
Great. Thank
and
you,
Mike.
And
give me the time again. Between 11 and what? Between 11 and 2?
Between 11 and 2 tomorrow on 5431 Hickory Grove Road.
Okay. Thank you, Hans.
Thank you, sir.
And this is going to be great. This is the first official technical and business charter high school in Charlotte, North Carolina. We have another call here. This board is lit up. Can't say anymore. Hello, who's this?
You talking
Hello.
To Joyce?
Joyce Waddell.
Yeah,
how
I've been waiting.
You?
I waited. I waited last week and you didn't get to me, but I couldn't get in a word edgewise. But I want to commend you on the great job that you're doing with this program. As you know, I consider you to be family because we've been together many for a long time when it comes to working in this community.
Well, I understand that. And so your husband was great working in this community also.
Absolutely. We have the E.E. Waddell School as a result of it.
Uh-huh. That's correct. Now, I did not realize because all these people call in, we are jammed. But
and
you're
out of time.
Yeah, but I want you to tell us about you are running for district.
I'm running for Senate 40. That's the seat previously held by Malcolm Graham. And, of course, you know, I worked very closely with Malcolm Graham for many, many years. And have an appreciation for the kind of work that he did. And District 40 is very near and dear to me. Many of the things that I'll be working for are some of the same things that will make this community move forward.
And what give me two things that you think are so important.
Things, of course, you know, I was just elected to Charlotte-Mecklenburg Board of Education for a second four-year term with more than 98% of the votes cast. And of any one individual with the highest percentage of votes, I had the most.
Well,
and so education is near and dear to me, having spent 30 years in education, classroom teacher, school administrator, and counselor. And so they're drafting bills right now concerning the very future of public education and of education for the state of North Carolina and Charlotte. You know, our biggest budget in education comes from the state. I want to be there where I can make a difference in what happens.
Well,
because they're asking us each and every week the direction to go in and approve of the decisions that are being made in the committees before going forward. And so I want to be there for people to come to me, for me to be right there at the table to help craft the future of education, looking at more and higher pay for teachers and state employees. Of course, you know, teachers right now, we're about the lowest, 47th, when it comes to pay, but we got to change that. I think the governor is committed to changing it, to doing some things, but we want the very best. We don't want just a small portion of an increase. We want a great increase because our teachers are very deserving of it, and our state employees are too. I'm also concerned about health care.
I don't have much time, but I want you
You want me to come back?
Yeah, absolutely want you to come back next week. But I want to ask you this question. When you, if you become the District 40 senator, what do you have to give up? You have to give up your board seat, correct?
I will. I'll give up the board seat, yes.
And there'll be a special election then, correct?
Yes.
Okay, good. Well, I wish you all the luck. You know,
and
my
thank
heart
you very much, and thank you for everything that you've done. We've worked well together in the past, and I'm certain that, you know, I'll continue to stick with you. I'll continue to stick with the things that you're working on. And I think you've made a difference in this community, and thank you for letting me be a part of that.
I'm just trying, but you've done quite more than I have. Thank you very much, Joyce. And
okay.
We will see you next. I want you to call in. See, you
right.
need to text me first to tell me you're calling in. Then I'll know it's you.
Oh, okay. I didn't know I had to text first because I just called in and I was just sitting waiting. But trying to get on the word right. edgewise, but I'll text first so that I can get right in. And thank you so much
right.
for letting me speak.
Thanks,
Joyce Waddell, Senate 40.
Okay. Thank you, Joyce. Okay. Let's go to that. This board has been going crazy today. Let's see who we have here. Where's the next one? This person has been waiting the longest, and let's see. Hello, who's this? Hello? Hello? They're not there. Hello, 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 hello. You've been waiting the longest. Okay.
Just listen.
That's fine. Okay, so we will go to the next person, and is, let's see, who is this? Yeah. Hello, who's this? Hello?
Marcus Brandon.
Marcus Brandon.
I didn't know if
How
you were
you?
Talking to me or not.
Yes. Well, you know, I need to say that, don't you get a ping or something on the phone when I pick up? I thought you'd get a ping. Well, Marcus Brandon, you have done a great job for District 60. Is that right?
That is correct.
How many terms have you been in District 60?
Two terms.
And yeah. and people who are not quite aware of what does District 60 in North Carolina cover?
Well, I have the privilege and honor of representing everybody in the state of North Carolina in the General Assembly, but I do that district is particularly in Guilford County, which is Greensboro in the Hopland area. And it's a very unique district because my district in High Point, that zip code is the poorest zip code in all the top 10 cities, and I have all the socials that come out of that, which is really reflected on my work in the General Assembly and the bills that we passed.
Okay. Now, do you know, and I'm going to ask you this question because you're the person that's in your district, what is the poverty rate in your district? Because I just want to see, we were talking about that that dummy, Paul Ryan, and he has 29,420 households in his district receive SNAP benefits, and 53% are working households. So,
mm-hmm.
you know, now, would you consider your district a rural or half rural?
I do have some rural. I just consider my district has a lot of urban poor, and but it's the same story, whether you're talking about rural poor or urban poor. We have which is the reason why I'm running for United States Congress is because I feel like that these communities, in particular, have been marginalized, in particular by the leaders that represent them. And I never learned that to be more true than when I actually got elected and served in the General Assembly. And what I realized was is that people were far too focused on being focused in representing their party instead of representing their constituency. And I saw these communities get marginalized. You cannot concentrate on a problem for 40 years and it get worse. And so when you have 41% of African-American males not graduating, or if you have 60% of our kids, no matter what color you are, that is not reading on grade level, and then you have the income inequality that you see with poor and rural families that they deal with, and all of those social ills come to highest HIV rates, highest infant mortality rates, more folks going to jail and to prison and not being able to have a second chance. So what I realized in my community, and the reason why I work the way I work, is that when you don't have a high school diploma and you have a felony, then you end up having 0% percent chance of making it in the society that we're working in. And so these are cancers of our community, and we're going to have to be able to address this because people are literally dying because of it. So I am about business and about getting things done, and I will let your listeners know that I have passed more bills than anybody in this race, and I have the highest effective rating, and I put two new schools in my district to help combat what I just talked about earlier, and I got the legislative year from the state employees because we negotiated with the Republicans to get teachers and state employees a raise for the first time in 6 years. So even though we all know that we have to deal with a different crowd in Raleigh than what you're used to, but the same crowd I face in Raleigh is the same crowd I'm going to face in Washington, D.C., and I'm the only one in this race that has passed bills and been able to be effective in that environment, and that's what we need. We need people that's going to represent the constituency and not necessarily do what they're told to do by their party.
Okay, now, yeah, that was great. I understand that, you know, but I always ask the question,
sure,
how do you deal with the robber barons that are in the House, in the U.S. House and in the State House, who don't pass jobs? What we need is jobs. And how do you get job legislation passed? That gets people to work. That puts money in the economy. And they do not want money in the economy. They want money in their own pockets.
It is, and it's exactly the problem. And so this is the reason why I am wanting to go to Washington, D.C., because what I learned in the State House is that there's a lot of money that comes down to deal with these exact issues that you're talking about. But what happens is that it becomes a part of a good old boy network, and the money never actually reaches to the folks that need it the most. It's not really, a lot of people talk about the investment and the money. It's that we spend a ton of money and have spent a ton of money on trying to address these problems, just the bureaucracy of the situation, it never reaches there. So I want to make sure that we stop treating Cincinnati, Ohio, the same way that you treat Charlotte, North Carolina, or Salisbury, North Carolina. The needs are totally different, and we need to be able to have a better mechanism in the terms of how that money is distributed, because everybody knows people who do the work, and you've been in the community for a long time, and you know that people do great work. We need to increase their capacity to do even more work. But what we do is that you see the people who do the best work never, ever are considered for the grants that come in, especially the block grants that come in from the federal government, and being able to move these organizations to reach the most capacity that they can reach. These are very important issues, and people don't really look at it that way, but it really is a matter of the way we deal with funding. And if I'm elected, I want to be able to break that stronghold in terms of how we deliver those funds and how we qualify people. I mean, in the legislature, I had many people come up to the State House and tell us all the work that they were doing, but never had one data to prove it, and not one evidence, and expected more money. I think we need to get out of that whole situation and really expect people, if you're going to come to government and use taxpayers' money, that you're going to have to prove the type of work that you're doing. And because simply to the matter, it's a very simple fact. The jobs can be there. When you're looking at poor communities and rural communities, there's lots of jobs. You have the houses and buildings that have been condemned, and you have infrastructure issues, and you have road issues and transportation issues that we can deal with, and it would be very beneficial if we would be able to do the training and all of that right there in the community. We have the power and the expertise and the workforce to be able to deal with that and be able to transform space and transform communities into livable communities, and we don't have to worry about these conversations that we're talking about with minimum wage. We can have conversations that talk about living wages, and to me, a living wage is not $10.10 an hour. A living wage is a lot more than that. If anybody can live on $10 an hour, please contact me, because I don't know if anybody can live off of that. And so we really have Brandon, to have a different conversation.
Representative Brandon, I want to thank you for coming on the show. We're really crowded for time today, but I would like you to call into the show next Friday. Send me a text telling me that you will do that, say around 3:30.
Okay.
You call into, because I want to expand what I want to ask you. Today we were just so jam-packed with people on the line here that I had to cut the show. How can they get a hold of you if they want to?
Well, I do have an office in Charlotte, and I'm on the south end on the corner of Tryon and Park, and we were excited about that, and we've been here for a couple of months, and you can also reach me at marcusbrandon.com, and it has my telephone numbers, and I'm also on Facebook and Twitter and all of the ways that people can reach me. But it's, again, it's marcusbrandon.com, and we have a physical office in Charlotte on the corner in south end on the corner of Tryon and West Park.
I appreciate everything you're doing, Marcus, and we will be speaking to you next week.
I look forward to it. Thank you so much.
You send me a text to know that you are going to be available next week so I can put you in the schedule. Thank you.
That's right. Thanks a lot. Mm-hmm.
Marcus Brandon, who is running for Mel Watzel's seat in the 12th District. Let's see. We have another. We're so full, and Grace will be with you. I see you. I got one more call. Let's see. Who's this? Hello. Who's this? 9313 is the last four of your number, and you have been holding. Hello. Okay. Just hold and listen then. That means it is time for... It's time for our doctor in the house.
Awesome. Hey, Dr. Michael. Hi, Michael. Hello. Hello. Boy, you had some awesome guests on today. You know, Joyce Waddell was a powerhouse, and Marcus Brandon, who's got just filled with ideas and good thoughts and plans. I mean, these are just... We're so fortunate that we have such great candidates. We really are.
Absolutely. And I want to know what is going on with our Council of State, particular, let's see, Miss Bess Wood, who I helped and walked miles to help her get elected, putting out signs with her, and she had nobody helping her. Tell us something.
Yeah. So, yes, I suppose I think you're referring to why she asked for the $500 back from the North Carolina Democratic Party.
Well, you have to contact because people may not know.
Okay. So Beth Wood sent a public email. And this is, you know, here's the thing. You can always ask for your money back. No problem. Ask for your money back.
Okay.
If you don't like it, ask for your money back. That's fine.
Explain who Beth Wood is first on the Council of State.
Beth Wood is our state auditor. She is one of the Democratic one of the Democrats that have been elected statewide, and she is our state auditor. Okay.
And what do they do?
So
what does the state auditor do? What is
the state auditor? All they do is audit the state's affairs. Okay. North Carolina state affairs. So she audits the governor's office. She audits the Department of Transportation. She audits all of those just divisions that deal with the state. That's it. She audits nothing else.
Now tell us the story in context.
Okay, so she asked for her money back from, she made a donation to the North Carolina Democratic Party. And she asked for the money back. And this all stemmed around the firing or the release of Robert Dempsey. Okay. You know, first of all, she has nothing to say about personnel issues of the North Carolina Democratic Party because the North Carolina Democratic Party has nothing to say about personnel issues with the auditor's office. They're two separate entities. Now, she didn't like the fact that Dempsey was fired, and she wanted her money back, that's fine. But she went public and accused the North Carolina Democratic Party of some nefarious and underhanded doings. So, and she gave the impression in her email that she made very public that she, as the state auditor, was not only was she aware of the of what she called, you know, underhanded dealings of the state, the Democratic Party, but that she had some knowledge of the auditing process of the North Carolina Democratic Party. And all of that is, in two words, bullpucky. Because she has absolutely nothing, repeat, nothing to do with the books of the North Carolina Democratic Party. As a state auditor, she deals with the North Carolina state, period. But
so,
this is what she did. She went public with that.
So, as they say on Star, at Battlestar Galactica, she had fracking nothing to do with the Democratic Party.
You got it. That's absolutely right. So, you know, this bothered me tremendously. And I'll tell you why it bothered me tremendously. If you recall last year when Pat McCrory was first elected and he went around talking about how he wanted to privatize Medicaid, he and Aldona Walsh came up with a set of numbers to quote-unquote prove their point that Medicaid had been so terribly mismanaged under the Perdue administration. Well, the numbers didn't mesh. They didn't jive. So then Beth Wood and her office was asked to come in and audit, and when we all heard that, we went, yay, because that's the strong Democrat. She speaks truth to power. She'll tell us the truth. Well, what she did was she came out and she actually carried the bucket for Pat McCrory and Aldona Walsh and covered for them by saying that the audit numbers were correct. That their numbers,
okay,
not audit, but their numbers were correct.
Okay, all right, let me stop you there now. What leads you to believe, okay, that she is now siding with the present administration and really not saying what is actually the truth?
Well, because something funny, something peculiar happened, and that is that the people, the CPAs and the people in the auditor's office all received a really nice raise last year. They all received a really nice raise last year, okay? And there was no other office that really received the insurance commissioner's office, which is Wayne Goodwin, they didn't receive a raise. And this is public record. I went and checked. This is public record. So isn't that odd that her office is the only office that received the CPAs in her office received this really nice raise? And plus there was some conversation about that McCrory wanted to make the auditor's office an appointed position out of the cabinet rather than elected official. Okay, which if that had happened, then, you know, Ms. Wood's position goes bye-bye. But isn't that odd? Because now the only person that could approve a raise anywhere for any department in North Carolina is the budget officer. And guess who is the budget officer?
Art Pope. I want to take
Art
all your money.
Art Pope. And so it just doesn't sit right with me that you would come out and defend Pat McCrory and Aldona Walsh, who are Rogers blind, but she would sell the Democratic Party up the river. That does not sit well with me.
Well, she has never been right since she got married, so I don't. Maybe she's married a Koch brother or something. The problem that you have with this is that she received this raise before she had
the people, her department, the people in her department,
she announced that this these figures were correct. Is that what you're saying?
Mm-hmm. I believe so. Yeah, absolutely. It was around the time. It might have occurred right after or right before, but yeah.
So, and then she was upset about Dempsey, the executive director, being dismissed.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay. What is the connection between her and Dempsey? Is there one yet?
We don't know.
Okay.
We don't know it gets stupid because she inserted herself into a conversation, a personnel matter. She inserted herself into a conversation that she should never have inserted herself into. That shows me a lack of judgment, number one. And number two, it's kind of fishy, particularly when you put into the situation, oh, really? If your department got raises and none of the others did, the CPAs and the insurance department didn't get a raise, but yours did, and you're carrying Pat McCrory's water, and now all of a sudden you are trying to destroy the she's trying to destroy the Democratic Party.
Well, I want to there's been something fishy about Beth for a long time because she used to be on my show almost twice, maybe three times a month. And for the last 2 years, ever since she got married, I could not even get her to call back. And I used to call her at 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock at night and get her.
Mm-hmm.
Never have I gotten a return call in the last 2.5 years from her. So there's something major going on here. If she inserted herself into the Dempsey, which is a personnel matter, there is a major problem here. And then she asked her money back, her $500 donation. I mean, what party member would ever ask for their money back if they were going to stay in the party?
I don't know.
Well,
I don't want to put two and two together and get 18, but it's just that there's so many funny things happening, peculiar things happening, and I just want to bring these out to people's attention because help me understand it, you know, Michael?
Well, there's the Kingfish used to say on television, it's too much of a coincidence to be coincidence. So this is very, very subtly done, and maybe we should think about having somebody run against her.
Maybe we should think about that.
When is she a real Democrat? When is she up? Is she up this November?
16, I believe. No, 16.
Okay. All right.
I believe she's up in 16.
She is going to be, we should still have somebody run against her.
I mean,
because none of this makes any sense. None of it. And I'm not saying because she has my show, it doesn't make any, doesn't make sense. But yes, I am. So the thing is that you're absolutely right, and this is a major problem. Now that we have the new ED, Casey Mann, who is a fabulous ED, and
he is fabulous.
The interview that I had with her, but we don't have time today, so I'll have to do that next week. We are going to be going on the right track, and the Republicans need to be aware because what some of these districts that they won, Obama carried. Redistrict them so they think that people are now scattered where they can't win. But as I was reading, were you on the phone when I was reading the United States? I mean, you know, these rural areas, they are getting the main back in the head. And, you know, you guys, out there in rural air, you better wake up because, you might have thought, well, it's only going to be those blacks in those urban areas in the city that they're going to take care of because they're taking all our money. No, you guys are taking all our money. You, 17.7%, 8.5 million people live in poverty in non-metropolitan areas. So the people out in Franklin County and all these other Republican counties, you're the one that's causing the drag on this economy because you're getting more of the SNAP benefits and more of the Social Security checks and more of the unemployment checks. It's you guys. So Paul Ryan is going to put a bat to your head because he wants to take it from you because he can't take it from the people in the inner city and take it and not really take it from you. So you guys are going to be in more trouble than we are because you're rural and you're not near a store. We might be poor, but we're near a store. So, you know, you got to think about that. And what else is going on in the Democratic Party while I have you, Madam Chair?
Well, we've got this other thing that Senator Hagan is attempting to run the coordinated campaign through Wake County. Okay, and I think we might have talked about this a little briefly before, you and I, Michael. But first of all, it's a bad idea to run an entire coordinated campaign through one county because what you do immediately is you piss off the other 99 counties.
Absolutely.
Without any doubt. Why would you want to pick one county, Wake County? And first of all, and then Wade Terriant does not have a reputation for excellent handling of funds, by the way. You know, that's the first thing. And the second thing is that they would have to be accredited with the Federal Elections Commission, and then they would have to be approved as a subsidiary of the Democratic Party. There's just so much and way too much to do. And then they would have to have a compliance team. That makes no sense to me. Why would Wade County go ahead and have another get another compliance team when we already have a compliance team very happily ensconced in the North Carolina Democratic Party? We already got one. Why are you duplicating that expense? We already have the beautiful Goodwin House that they could use for their offices, but no, they want to go rent another space. So that's another expense. Okay, you're talking about idiocy here.
Well, what do you think the reason is?
Well, I believe this all started with Robert Dempsey. And I believe that Robert Dempsey's, and this is my personal feeling, okay? So
The dead rise again. Go ahead.
The dead rises again. You got it. So I believe that Robert Dempsey was doing his very best to bankrupt the North Carolina Democratic Party and funnel everything through the Hagan campaign, because I firmly believe that there is a faction of people that absolutely do not want to move forward. They are the antithesis of progressives. They are the antithesis of liberals. They are the old Dixiecrats. They are the people who refuse to come into the 20th century, the 21st century, who still believe, even though they may absolutely object and say, oh, no, we don't believe in this, but their actions belie their words, they still believe in some form of slavery. They still believe in class warfare, and this is in the Democratic circles, by the way, okay, and they still believe that if you are a brown person or a person that is not white, that you must be subservient to the person who is white. And I am just calling it like it is, Michael. A lot of people may not like it, but you know what? I am calling it like it is.
Well, what else can I say? See, you took the words right out of my mouth. I don't understand. You must be reading my mind. That was exactly what I was going to say. I mean, you see,
yeah,
it's a
Vulcan mind warp.
The problem is, it's like you putting breadcrumbs all around your windows, and especially in the kitchen, and then you wonder why you got ants. I mean, these people, they did not come out of the woodwork until this president, Barack Obama, was elected. Now we know. Now we know who all these people are. We know who they are.
Let me tell you something else. In 2008, you do know that the majority of the superdelegates of the North Carolina Democratic Party went with Hillary Clinton. And the people who went for Barack Obama were tremendously ostracized. Tremendously so. They were criticized.
Yes, absolutely correct. Well, when it was first announced was running, I was for Hillary Clinton. And they tried, for months to try to get me to come over to Barack Obama. I said, no, I can't do it. But once I heard this man, this president of ours speak, I said, I have to go with him. And it was not because he was African-American. It was because that I thought he would be the right person now. And now I think Hillary Clinton is the right person to take us first. And this has always been the way in society. It's always been that way. And I'm a man, so, I thought that way too. But, I was taught by my mother. My mother was the smartest person I ever met in my life. The smartest person. Smarter than me, as a matter of fact. Anyway, but she was the
smartest. Is that possible?
Yes, it was, because I know the person that was. And she always told me, she said, don't forget, women are smart also. But remember, it's always been we're going to have a hard time because men think they are in control, but they are not in control. So just remember that. Hillary Clinton will get elected despite what these racists and despite what these neocons say, she will be elected president. And in 2014, they can kiss all these other counties goodbye because there will be more minorities in those districts, no matter even if they redistrict. They can't redistrict them again. They only had one shot at this.
Yep.
One shot. And then it's going to be over. And in Texas in 2024, it will be a blue state. Maybe before.
Oh, I'm thinking I'm thinking earlier. I'm thinking earlier, absolutely.
So,
I'm thinking earlier.
One other thing before yes, go ahead. Go ahead.
So we've got, you know, what we have to do, all of us brown people, yellow, brown, purple, all of us people of color, we need to let Kay Hayes' office know. So I'm asking you guys to pick up the phone, call her office. I don't have a number right off the top of my head. But call her office, email her office, and tell her that this move to Wake County, funneling the money to Wake County, is a sad, sad mistake. Because she's not only going to neglect, even though they're saying, her campaign office is saying, oh, no, we won't neglect the other counties. We're going to establish offices in other counties. The question then is, well, if you've got, you know, let's say, $12 million, why would you funnel all $12 million to one county? If you're really going to have a multi-county plan, then divide it up by 100 counties, you know? What your intention is.
Now, some people might not know. Tell us how, briefly, because I get these other guests, tell us how this system of the coordinated campaign is supposed to work.
Okay, so the coordinated campaign is supposed to work by including all the people that are running, with Kay Hagan at the top of the ticket, and all the other state races and the local races, commissioner races, you know, and all of those races. So that's the coordinated campaign. It's supposed to be able to help all Democrats up and down the ticket. That's as simple as I can make it.
And
so she wants to run it all through Wake County. Well, Wake County is not the only county that has people running.
Right. Well, okay. Now, what happens in, you know, in Greece, when people run for people, what do they have to do?
What, your listeners you're talking about, you know, complain.
No, no.
Tell them not.
People who are running for office. Say, Marcus Brandon. What would he have to do now?
He would have to call Kay Hagan's office and tell him it's a bad idea. So does Ms. Waddell.
Okay. How would
all
he get
of you
money?
Got everyone... That's a good question. That's a good question. How would he indeed get any help or assistance? That's a good question. This is supposed to be a coordinated campaign.
That means all the counties how this is going to work.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Too many unanswered questions.
Well, it is. It just seems to me that we did not know how much Dempsey was screwing up this Democratic Party in the state.
Oh,
when
seriously.
And he was not in there that long, but he must have been working night. He must have been working night and day. We're trying to right the ship now. We have good people in place, and Randy Bowler is, in my estimation, has been a great leader so far. Now we have a Casey Mann on board as ED.
Yep.
I think we can turn the ship around. Now,
I think we can.
Well, we're going to have a major story coming up. Now we're talking about the Shannon Nemody case, and I don't know how much time you have, but we're going to be talking about that on half hour here. And it's almost come to a head. We're now getting major people. There's been at least 5 or 6 blogs that have written about this. Now there's a couple of newspapers that are taking all the information, and they're going to start publishing. And you're welcome to listen to, and I'll leave your mic open in case you have a question you want to ask. Okay.
Okay. Well, I'll be listening in. Okay.
Okay. Thanks,
Michael.
Right now we're going to this other gentleman right here who has been a major force in the Shannon Nemody case. He's the first one that started writing the blogs about it, and it's the peopleschampion.me. and Mr. David Adams. How are you, David?
Good afternoon, Michael. Always a pleasure to be on the show, as well as greetings to your guest this evening.
So tell us, David, give us what has happened. Not obvious what has happened. Give us an overview of what and how this whole thing got to where it is today.
Okay. Well, first of all, Shannon Amodi is an African American who was born in the United States. He lived. He was actually working as an electrical assistant. He was visiting some friends in the small town of Youngsville, North Carolina, back on August 16th of 2012. Shannon came to the aid of a woman who was in distress, who had apparently been shot in the head, shot in the face, actually. He stayed there and he comforted the lady while she was in distress. He led the police and the EMS to her location. Subsequently, Shannon was charged with this lady's, the crime with shooting this lady about 10 or 11 hours later, despite the fact that the woman initially saying and other witnesses saying that Shannon wasn't the person who did it, and also saying that there was a white male fleeing from the scene. Shannon Amodi was still charged with this horrific crime. He has been locked up in the Franklin County Detention Center ever since. His case was taking off of the North Carolina, or actually the county's court management system docket on February 20th of 2013. He has not been in front of a judge in over a year. He's been placed on segregation, which is solitary confinement. He has been denied access to his mother. A number of things have happened in this young man's case. It is a horrific situation that he's in now. He's being held in, very horrific conditions. There is a tremendous degree of support now developing nationally, as you've already said, Michael, regarding this young man's case. But that's pretty much the nutshell of his story.
Where is he being held at?
He's being held in Lewisburg, North Carolina, at the Franklin County Detention Center.
So that is Franklin County, Guantanamo Bay North. Is that correct?
Right. Right.
So when his mother last saw him, was he chained or anything?
No, he wasn't. He wasn't. Well, actually, the last time his mom saw him, she saw him twice. I believe they were both in January. Once a Superior Court judge drove her to the jail and demanded that she was able to see her son. There was no contact.
Idea. Let me stop right there, David. I mean, a Superior Court judge don't drive mothers or anybody to see a prisoner. How did that take place? I mean, what prompted? Yeah, how did a judge, Superior Court judge, take anybody to see somebody in jail only unless he knew him? Now, he didn't know her from Adam.
That was a very kind gesture. That was a very kind gesture. The gentleman who did that, his name was Robert Hopgood. I mean, actually, and I've been doing a little bit of investigation about Judge Hopgood. He does have an extensive civil rights record, okay, in that community. It was a situation where he did it out of the kindness of his heart to take the mother there. And he told the officials at the jail that he wasn't going to leave until the mother saw her son. Okay, before that, she had been denied to see him. She had been given the opportunity or granted the time to see her son. She met with them, with Shannon. And then there was another time where someone who was familiar with the sheriff called and requested that she saw him. But each time that she saw this young man, he was surrounded by the jail officials, the lieutenants, the captains, and the sergeants at the jail. He wasn't afforded the typical visitation that any other prisoner was given. And it's very discouraging. I'm wondering why this young man is being denied access to his family and not afforded the same privileges as any other detainee at that facility.
Is he considered a terrorist?
Now, I don't know. The crimes for which he charged are not, under the Patriot Act bill or some kind of national security situation.
Then,
what strange intimidation is going on that you have the entire all the police, the entire staff. That's the thing. I've never heard it ever.
Well, you know, again, you know, it's a Franklin County jail. The sheriff runs that jail, and I suspect that, you know, he's being held in those conditions and treated that in that way at the behest of the sheriff himself, Mr. Jerry Jones. Actually, the mother, I guess you're going to have her on later, but the mother went called the jail just past Tuesday, which was his visit, regular visiting day, and she was told on the phone that I don't think Shannon is allowed to see anyone. You know, and why is that? You know, and I've also researched that, you know, since it's a county jail, he cannot be held in those conditions unless he's violated some sort of prison rule or something, unless it was, you know, his detention and segregation is actually for, disciplinary purposes. So
well,
why isn't this mother being allowed to see this man?
Right, and well, what was the reason they gave? Why was that asked? Why he's in solitary?
Yeah, she did. She called. I mean, she requested to speak to someone else. They transferred to another person. That person told her, "Well, there's no restrictions for Shannon as far as visitation in the system." So she then spoke to Captain Gill, and Captain Gill told her, "Well, your son did not put your name down on the list." And this is what they've repeatedly been saying, that he's not putting her name down on the list. And she asked him, "Well, you know, has he been afforded that slip, that form, to request a visitor?" Or to allow, to indicate who he wants to see, you know. And, I just can't see. It's unconscionable for this young man who's been locked up for over 18 months, held in the solitary confinement sort of condition, and not want to speak to his mother, the woman who gave birth to him. So they're playing games, you know, with this situation. You know, and I believe it's all being done at the behest of the sheriff.
So... is there an option of like getting him moved to another facility or out of the county? Is there anything that can be put in legally? Is there some kind of paperwork that can be put in to transfer or force a transfer? Just so that
I'm
getting conditions.
Not familiar with that particular jurisdiction's procedures in terms of where they're going to house the individual, whether he can be transferred to another facility. I doubt very seriously, since he's charged with the crime in that area, I doubt very seriously if there's any other correctional facility in that area that would hold a pretrial detainee. The only other alternative is that he gets sent to some type of state facility where he would be, you know, if once he's get there's a disposition of his case.
Is he charged for the crime? Is he charged with a crime?
Yeah, he's charged with two counts. He's charged with one, attempted murder, okay, and he's charged with larceny of a firearm, okay? However, the case was taken off of the court docket. The whole process has been, it's been a whole charade, you know? It was taken off of the docket back in February 20, 2013. Mysteriously, these continuances for the case have just started to pop back up here January 14th. Prior to February 20th of 2013 and January 14th of 2014, there had been no motions filed for a continuance, okay? There had been no paperwork in there stating that a judge had granted a continuance, okay? There's nothing in there to establish why this case has been continued. And there's no timetable having been set for when this trial is going to come back. This case is going to come back on the docket. So, and basically, this young man is being held hostage in the Franklin County Jail without pending charges.
Hey, this is Gracie Galloway. I don't know if I'm on air or not, but I have a question. Has anyone seen this young man in the last year? Has she physically laid eyes on this young man in the last year?
Yes, his mother has seen him twice, I believe, in the month of January.
Oh, this... January 2013 or 14?
2014.
Okay, so that, and he seems to be in good health.
Well, you're talking about a young man who went to jail for the first time who had no prior brushes with the law.
He doesn't have any bruises on him or he doesn't have, here's what I'm saying, there's no evidence of any kind of mistreatment. I'm just, because I'm really perturbed by this whole thing. You know,
yeah,
why
well,
would they want to hide if there's something that doesn't fit right, if it doesn't pass the smell test? They're hiding something.
Well, David, tell the story, which you did not say. Tell the rest of the story about the CI.
Okay.
Yes, well, actually, the crime occurred, like I said, on August 16, 2012, around about 2:30 in the morning. Shannon was taken into custody, mysteriously, about 3:10 p.m. that same day. Okay. Now, I don't know how they determined that Shannon was the person who did it, because the initial police reports indicated that the victim didn't even know who had shot her. Okay? She didn't even know that she was shot. Okay? They didn't have fingerprints on him because the kid didn't have a criminal past, so his fingerprints wouldn't have been in any kind of database. Okay? They didn't have DNA analysis on him because that was ordered after he had been taken into custody. So on the 17th, one of the police officers wrote an incident report where some guy came forward and said that he knew another man who had heard Shannon and the victim's daughter conspiring to kill her mother and steal $65,000 from her home. Okay? Now, the thing is, this young man, once the cops eventually did catch up with him, he told them that Shannon had actually asked or requested to borrow his shotgun, okay, to commit the crime. And he showed the investigators this alleged text exchange between Shannon and him. Okay, so the State Bureau of Investigations acquired a search warrant affidavit for Shannon and the victim's daughter's Facebook pages. Okay, after that search warrant was conducted, it was revealed that Shannon had no communication with the victim's daughter or this alleged confidential informant, or CI, as he had alleged. Now, in my mind, the course of the entire investigation should have shifted, okay, because it's against the law in most jurisdictions in this country to lie to the police, which is essentially what this young man did, okay?
Mm-hmm.
But Shannon was still charged with this crime, despite that exculpatory amount of evidence showing that he had no communication and clearly dismissed their conspiracy theory that he had conspired with this young girl to kill her mother.
And the other thing is that she was not shot with a shotgun. She was shot with a rifle.
Here's the thing. The second charge that Shannon is charged with is larceny of a firearm, which is larceny of a .22 caliber weapon. Now, when Captain Mitchell of the Franklin County Sheriff's Department filed for his search warrant affidavit to process that crime scene on the 16th, which is the day of the crime, okay, the search and seizure log of all of the items that were taken from that home, okay, indicates that the victim's .22 caliber rifle for which Shannon was accused and charged with stealing, okay, was actually one of the items that were taken from the home. So how are you going to charge the young man with stealing a .22 caliber rifle when you seized it from the home yourself and the kid was already in custody?
Tell us about the money.
Okay, yes, the money was mysteriously found the same day, not too far away, okay? The money was found, I think it was like a little less than the $64,000 that it was, a little less than that, but the money was found at an abandoned home, not too far away, shortly after the crime. And I'm wondering where that information came, where the cops got that information as to where the money was. Shannon was already in custody. The young girl, the victim's daughter, who was supposedly this young man's co-conspirator, were already in custody. So who told the cops where to go and get that money?
And tell us, Thomas, about the Facebook page.
Oh, I saw that. He knows this as well. I think Mr. Adams, actually, I saw a picture on the People's Champion site of it. But there's the guy in the neighborhood who is kind of the suspect number one that we're looking at, but this man in the neighborhood, well, young man in the neighborhood, who is apparently a thug and involved in quite a few different criminal activities, and somehow seems to be related to or connected to this sheriff that we've been talking about. But he is the person who is physically described as committing the crime by witnesses at the scene. And he's the same guy who later showed up with a Facebook post with him and the money all over his bed. Yeah, y'all should be interested in me. So why is this guy not in prison or, you know, being held indefinitely as well?
So there's no fingerprints. There's no DNA. There's no eyewitness, except this woman now has changed her story. And tell us why, what she was told that might change her story, David.
Well, when I interviewed Rhonda McLean, who was actually the victim in this particular crime, she had told me that she had given two separate versions prior to me even talking to her. She had given Detective Bird of Franklin County Sheriff Department one version, stating that when she came out of her bedroom, someone jumped out of the closet. Now, her bedroom's on the second floor, jumped out of her closet and struck her in the head with a pole. Now, she told Lieutenant M. Little of the Youngsville Police Department that she had heard a noise because her daughter had been sneaking guys in the house and she was monitoring the situation. She heard a noise. She thought someone had came in her front door. She went downstairs, okay, and checked on her daughter, and someone stepped from behind a sliding glass door and hit her in the head with a pole. When I spoke with her, she told me that she came out of her bedroom on the second floor. She saw the closet door move, and it startled her, but she went downstairs. She thought she had saw a young man in her home, and she went to her daughter's room and asked her daughter who was that and what she was doing, and that's when Shannon DeMody allegedly jumped from out of the bathroom and shot her in the face. Okay, now, I reminded her of the other reports, but the lady somehow strangely told me that the district attorney in this case, who is Annette Sellers, had told her that Shannon DeMody, his mother, Elizabeth Crudup, wasn't in fact his biological mother, that Shannon had been adopted, and that Shannon was from a royal family out of Africa, and that they were paying for his legal fees because they didn't want the family's name smeared in the public in the United States. Now, I don't know what whoever's paying his legal fees would have to do with this young man's guilt or innocence, okay? But we suspect that someone in the prosecutor's office or even the sheriff's office fed this woman this story, causing her to change course in what her initial statements were, because she's possibly thinking that she's going to get some kind of civil suit against this young man if he's convicted. So that's why we believe her story has changed.
Okay, tell us where this woman is at now. She's no longer in Lake Livingsburg. Where's she at?
Well, she told me during my interview that she still owns a home in Youngsville, North Carolina, which is actually 109 Sheeran Court, where the crime occurred. But she's actually in Raleigh, North Carolina now, because she says she's fearful for her safety. Okay? I don't think she's fearful of her safety that someone's going to – I think she's fearful because she knows the persons who shot her, okay? And I think she knows that those individuals are related to Sheriff Jerry Jones, and I think that she's afraid of Sheriff Jerry Jones herself.
Because, well, why would she move if the man who did it is in custody?
Yeah, if the man's in jail indefinitely, forever.
Right. Now tell us. Go ahead.
Just before we get off too far, at least this bizarre royal family African is his name on the birth certificate, really Barack Obama storyline that got inserted into this, because that is completely left field. I mean, at least the other thing is a crime occurred. He was actually kind of at the scene. And, you know, the police and all could, you know, mistake that he's the guy or whatever. At least that's all plausible and real. But what is this just suddenly he's secret African nobility? What is that about?
David?
It doesn't make sense. I mean, it doesn't make sense. I mean, it doesn't make sense because it has nothing to do with the case. Okay? And that's what's so bizarre about it. Okay, and the only plausible explanation that I could come up with is this woman is seeking possibly to, you know, benefit from it from a civil side after this kid is convicted. Okay, now she clearly never told anyone that Shannon DeMody shot her. Okay, if you look at the cops initial, the primary officer's reports, she indicates to both of them, okay, that she didn't know who struck her. She didn't even indicate that she had been shot. She said someone struck her with a pole in both incidents. Okay. Not only that, But the captain, when he filed in his search warrant affidavit, when he filed it for the police to be able to go in and process her home, which was the crime scene, he also indicated in his report that once they got there, it was determined that the suspected shooter was no longer at the scene. So you're talking about the commander of the Franklin County Sheriff Department even indicating before a sworn affidavit before a judge that they believe, that the police believe, that the suspected shooter wasn't at the scene. So how is it that Shannon was charged with this crime, 10 hours later? You know, it's just incredible.
Now, the daughter, who supposedly is in jail, was what, 16 at the time or 15?
She was 15 at the time.
Okay, so...
Supposedly had solicited Facebook requests to have somebody kill her mother. If they could, or her, so that they could kill her mother. That's the truth. She was charged with the crime and her mother, is that correct?
Well, is she still in prison? Do we know, David?
Well, actually, first of all, we won't know. I have not been able to obtain any kind of records pertaining to her disposition, her charges, the disposition of her charges in this case, because she's a juvenile. And typically, I don't think I'm going to be able to find any kind of record publicly. But the mother told me that her daughter had been charged and subsequently had her case resolved in the juvenile courts, and she had received a 2-year sentence. So it's almost time, if that's true, it's almost time for her to come home. Okay, and Shannon Shannon's case hasn't even made it out of the pretrial stages.
That's because they keep losing the case in that file that grows and shrinks and grows and shrinks by hundreds of pages every time you go by.
Right. Tell us about the money and the supposed lawyer, Mr. Klinkerson, who supposedly received the money.
Yeah, well, when this first happened, the family, Namodi family, were considering hiring a well-established law firm, Cheshire, Parker, Schneider, and Bryan, okay, to represent Shannon. Initially, one of the counsels for that firm, Mike Klinkerson, interviewed the family, and it was determined that they didn't feel that Mr. Klinkerson would be a good fit to represent Shannon. They left, and they told him, please don't take the case. As they were leaving, the sister of Miss Elizabeth Crudup went in behind the family's back and gave this man a certified check for $30,000. Okay, now why she did that, that's a whole entire different story. You could have blog talks forever to talk about that. Okay, since that time, Mr. Klinkerson has also been paid another $20,000. From one of Mr. Namodi's family members in Africa. He sent additional $20,000 to help the family pay for this young man's legal fees. Mike Klinkerson took that money and hasn't done anything to help this young man. Actually, when I started widely publishing this case, he went into the jail. He went to the Franklin County Jail and actually visited Shannon and threatened him and told him that if you talk to your mother or anyone else in this case and try to hire another attorney, I'm going to help the prosecution convict you and make certain that you get 30 years in prison. Okay? Now, this is his attorney, the man who paid $50,000 to represent this young man who did this. Now, this is nothing fabricated. This is not something that was just coming out of the wind. The young man called his mother and told her as much. Okay? That the man had come and threatened. He even told her, I can't talk to you anymore because I'm going to get 30 years in jail.
Now, here's the story. One, when it first came to court, he was put on a $500,000 bond. Are you kidding me? I mean, what? They found the money.
Yeah.
There is no legal evidence that this man did it.
So there's no murder.
Nobody died. They have the gun.
And they have the suspect, supposedly. So why?
Yeah, it reminds me of the movie In the Heat of the Night, where the sheriff said, "I got the wallet that was missing and the body that is dead." I mean, they have none of that. They have nothing. they got the money and they have the gun, but they have no evidence that this young man ever used it.
Well, Michael, in all fairness, I've been told by several sources that are close to the case of Shannon that they allegedly do have some type of a culpable evidence against Shannon. If they do, if any of that exists, it has not been made public. It has never been made public.
But is it in the file?
No, it's not in the file. Now, the search warrant, there was a search warrant issued for Shannon on the 17th to obtain his DNA. Okay, those findings, I believe, came back in May of 2013. That's not in there. Whatever that discovery is pertaining to that, that's not in the file. Okay, now the DA may have it, and his attorney, Mike Klinkerson, may have it, but it has not been made public. Okay, the fingerprint. There was a fingerprint on the sliding glass door that was widely talked about in the news when his first crime first happened. I'm quite certain that they've gotten Mr. Amodi's fingerprints by now and made some type of a match to that. That's not in the file, okay? There's nothing, any of this traceable evidence that you would normally find in these kinds of crimes, none of that's ever been made public, and it's not in the file of the Franklin County Courthouse.
Well, if they had fingerprints and DNA that this young man did it, why ain't he in front of a judge?
That's the million-dollar question.
I have.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, hey, you know, you don't have to be Perry Mason to think that up. I mean, if they
all you have to think is if you've got the money and you've got the wrong guy, but you just want a fall guy, you
that's
might be in a box and
no.
You sweat him until he
tests. You need that?
Because that's the only chance you got.
Well,
otherwise, you're just torturing an innocent child.
So that's
what's going
on. Do you need that? There is something.
Yeah, and I think one of the most, and I think another real absolute clarity is that whoever committed this crime is out there. He's out there, having gotten away scot free from having committed a really horrible crime.
This is a situation I want David to give us a background on it. But the people in Lewisburg are afraid of this relative of the sheriff. He has sort of a little thing together. Tell us a little story about that, about the woman who contacted you, David.
Yeah, a number of people have contacted me through Facebook and other means regarding the, this particular crime and the alleged people who actually committed it. Now, I'm gonna go on record and say who they are. The young man's name is Donald Chalk. Is the gentleman that they're saying actually shot Rhonda McClain in the face. And also, he just happens to be, you know, mysteriously be the source of this conspiracy theory, okay? Donald Chalk told the gentleman who investigated this angle of the case from the SBI, the State Bureau of Investigations, that Shannon had communicated with them via text message and that he had been communicating with a young girl on Facebook, okay? Those results, the report, mysteriously appeared in a file at the county courthouse showing that he lied. Shannon never communicated with the girl on Facebook or never communicated with him. Okay? So, and this is the young man that your guest just stated that's walking around the community. Him and his brother, Stephen Chark, are accused of other violent crimes in the community. There's a person who came forward and said that he actually shot another person in the community. They've been committing armed robberies. Okay? If you go to their Facebook pages, which I'm quite sure Thomas has already seen, they're posting all their pictures with guns. Okay? But the bottom line is there are a number of people who were there at that night who saw a white male fleeing from the scene shortly after the shooting took place. They told the cops as much that night. Okay? But the police never indicated any of this information in any of the reports that were filed. Okay, from both police agencies, the Franklin County Sheriff's Department or the Youngsville Police Department. The people in that community are essentially terrified of the sheriff and these particular relatives. And it's just unconscionable in 2014 that you have this Wild Wild West kind of atmosphere, okay, which directly impacts the entire public safety of that community. You know, it's an outrage, and it's an outrage, Michael, as many politicians or people who are trying to run for posts that come on your show and try, and where you give them a platform, okay, to present their case why they want to represent the people, you know, that they haven't had the gumption or the guts to stand up for not only Shannon Amodi, but the people within the Franklin County, the Youngsville community down there. It's just a travesty of justice.
It is.
Now, this Donald Chalk is also was also posted on Facebook with the money.
Right. And is it not accurate that he's wearing the clothing that was described from suspect that night? The picture?
Yeah, the guy that they said ran away had on a black sweatsuit.
And on Facebook, Donald Chalk is sitting next to the money with the victory sign or something. Isn't that correct?
Yeah, yeah. And he also made a comment on there stating that they should be arresting me tonight, but I don't think they will. I don't think they're going to lock me up.
So has anybody ever asked where all that money came from and went to that he had in the picture? Like maybe it was left in an abandoned home?
I have a Mary. Are you still with us, Mary?
Yes, I am, and I really appreciate the panel coming to talk to the case regarding Shannon Nairobi. I've learned a lot from listening, and I wrote the story in my blog, I think, almost very early in Human Rights for Prisoners March, and I know Elizabeth Crudup is a very wonderful person and a wonderful mother. And we've had another recent case where an individual was arrested and much hip-lock went on because they had arrested this individual on not only a crime he didn't do, but on a crime that never happened. And they kept this young man in prison 4.5 years without any trial. They don't intend to actually have a trial for Shannon Nairobi, just like they didn't for Terrell Scott. They don't intend to have a trial. They don't intend to put this evidence that they don't really have on trial. They intend to break him down. I'm a prisoner activist, and I know that 25% of the wrongful convictions result from false confessions by children and the mentally ill. Now, Shannon Nairobi isn't exactly a child, but he was very near a child at 18 when they arrested him. He was a very gently raised young man. He's never been in environments where people were out there in the street. He's never been subjected to anything that ghetto boys, let's just say, would have experienced. So he's not a streetwise person. And I think that they had every hope that he would confess to a crime he did not do. And they have reason to think that because they already know that 25% of the wrongful, of the false confessions, 25% of the wrongful convictions come from children and the mentally ill. And the other thing is that we know that solitary confinement is known to be able to run sane people insane. So since he wasn't mentally ill when they got him, they intend to break him down by sensory deprivation. They plan to run him crazy, and that's the purpose of having him in solitary confinement. It's illegal. It's terrible, and I tell you something, it does not say much for the governor of North Carolina, who I've been tweeting about this. It does not say much for any of the justice officials, even in Washington, that this young man has been deprived of his Sixth Amendment right because it would embarrass the sheriff. It would embarrass his attorney. It would embarrass them for him to have his Sixth Amendment right, which is to a speedy public trial with adequate defense. A lawyer who has been threatening Shannon Nairobi with 30 years of prison and threatened also his aunt, as I understand it, saying that if you fire me, I'm going to work with the prosecutor and see that he gets 30 years. First of all, that's illegal. Somebody who has been your defense attorney cannot legally work with the prosecutor against you. But you see, these people, the aunt is from another country, and he might think that he can say things like that and get away with it and actually strike fear in their heart. So these people are completely running over Shannon Naimoody and his mother, and we are going to start protesting this. His mother plans that we will start protesting on Monday, either at 12 noon and then at again at 5 o'clock, from 12 noon until 1 o'clock and then from 5 o'clock until 6 o'clock every Monday. And we ask everybody to go to their nearest courthouse. You don't have to go to Franklin County, North Carolina. Go to your nearest courthouse with a sign that says Free Shannon Naimoody. Because I'm telling you that Shannon is not the first or the worst case of this, where they simply arrest a black person and with no intention of taking the case to trial. And then they proceed to keep that person, and they proceed to try to break that person down until they will accept a plea deal. And once they accept a plea deal, then they never have to take it to trial, and that person ends up with a record for something they did not do, and they end up paying probation on something that they did not do. And so this is the plan for Shannon Naimoody, but it's the plan that will not work. Because we, the people, are going to stand up for our Sixth Amendment rights. These are our Sixth Amendment rights. It's not just about Terrell Scott. It's not just about Shannon Naimoody. If this works with those two individuals, and it already worked with Terrell Scott, they kept him 4.5 years. His attorney and the prosecutor would trade places. The attorney would ask for a continuance. And the next time the prosecutor would say that Terrell Scott was unavailable for trial, he would say that Terrell Scott was in a mental hospital and Terrell Scott was sitting right in prison. So his perjury is right on record. And so these people traded off lying to keep Terrell Scott's case out of trial, and it went on for 4.5 years. So I'm familiar with the ploy they're doing. And they're doing this to Shannon Naimoody now. And if it works for him, they will be able to pick up any person they want, especially black youths, and put any charges against them because they have no intention of ever taking it to trial anyway. They just say they did anything. And then they keep them in solitary confinement, which is torture, and keep them there until they're willing to lie on themselves. That is how we, the people, are supposed to lose our Sixth Amendment rights. And okay, I say Mary, we need to get out here and protest.
Mary, this is very similar to a case that was in Pennsylvania just a little while ago, where we found out that the judges were taking money to lock kids up in jail for more than 10 years. Over 3,000 people were locked up.
It was a business.
And here's the problem. It wasn't a lot of money. This one judge, he was sentenced to 28 years, and he was just interviewed. I saw him 2 days ago interviewed on TV, and he said, well, I was doing them a favor because I was trying to teach them that they can't do certain things. And I think what broke the camel's back was this young lady who did something, compared to jaywalking in her school, and she was taken out by one of the policemen in the school and came from him, and he threw the book at her and gave her 30 months.
Right.
So, this is going on possibly all across the country, and it is probably going on in Guantanamo Bay, Franklin County, North Carolina. So you're absolutely correct.
The other young man I spoke to you about, Terrell Scott, he's also from Pennsylvania. And as I said, they kept him 4.5 years and denied him a trial. So Terrell Scott's case proves that we need to get serious about Shannon Naimoody, because people's brains actually change shapes. It actually, your brain actually changes physiologically, locked up in solitary. So they're waiting for him to go crazy. That is what they plan for Shannon and Modi. And we don't know if they're keeping him from his family. They won't let him have visitors. The only person he ever sees is this attorney coming forward telling him, you need to sign the plea. You need. That's all Terrell Scott saw.
And the prosecutor as well. The prosecutor as well. Now, the prosecutor has been permitted to go and solicit a plea deal from Shannon without the presence of his legal counsel. That in itself is illegal.
I bet you the legal counsel agreed to it because they're working together.
Well, the legal counsel has not seen him in I don't know how long. And when he was told, when the legal counsel was asked by the judge in the courtroom, in a continuous, it was continued because he was not there because he's on another murder case. So evidently in this huge, huge law practice of Cheshire and Parker in Raleigh or Wake County, they only have one person to handle this case, which is just
somebody should motion for reduced bond. That was his duty, to motion for a reduced bond and motion for a speedy trial. He did neither. He's been working against this young man since the inception of this case. We found out that the attorney for Terrell Scott did not even enter his entry of service as counsel, not when he first got the people's $10,000. He did it a year later, and he also put in a withdrawal for the case. So what I'm saying is we have dirty defense attorneys, not just the ones who are appointed by the court, but the ones who take your money, who are actually working against their clients. That's what we have in the Shannon and Modi case, and we had it in the Terrell Scott case, and I'm sure it's been true in other cases across the country, and we need to put our foot down and say, you will not arrest our children and keep them forever without a speedy trial just because you send us a dirty attorney. You will not be able to do that regardless of what you do because we the people will not stand for it. It could be your child. It could be your nephew. It could be your neighbor. It can be anyone next because I'm telling you, this is not something that just happened to Shannon Nalmody. It is a new way of depriving African-American youth of a free and speedy trial. It is a way of just enslaving people like 12 years a slave without due process of law. And we don't need to stand for that. We need to do something about it. Thank you.
Well, Mary, I agree with you 100%, but there's a little caveat here. I think they're just doing this to African-American kids because they need to fill jails. They're building private jails all across this country because
prison profiteers, yes.
Absolutely. I mean, I think Florida, I think has the second most private jail system next to Arizona in the country. I mean, that's the new wave, and you don't have to account for them. You don't have to pay Social Security. You don't have to pay the sickness. You don't have to pay pension to these jailers. You just give them money, bring them up the street, and they're in jail. So, but the thing to hear is this, I think, is a little more than that. This child.
Yeah, well, Michael, for North Carolina, for that particular jurisdiction down in Franklin County, you remember last week when Beth Crudup was on, she told you guys what the county clerk told her. You know, this pre-printed form that they're using, whenever there's not enough evidence, it's the form that the judge uses to hide a person. Now, the county clerk said that. You know, it's not something that was verbatim. The county clerk said that when a judge, you know, they don't have enough evidence to pursue charges, that form is used to take the case off the docket, you know, for the judge uses it to hide a person.
So you're telling me that they are throwing away the 14th Amendment due process, people in custody, until they got enough evidence?
Yeah, well, that's what the county clerk told Beth Crudup. Now, we, of course, know that because of the way they're going to house this particular defendant, they're going to put him in segregation, you know. And like Mary was just talking about how that causes mental health. You know, I was reading some articles just recently where they're saying that, you know, permanent brain damage comes from that kind of confinement within the first couple of days. Permanent brain damage. Okay, so we know that they're going to house them in that kind of situation, like she said, to force a confession out of them, you know, and that's what they're doing, you know. And since when is it the judge's decision to hide a person until there's enough evidence? Isn't that something that should be meted out between the two counsels, the defense and the prosecution?
Yeah, if anybody, I swear the DA would do that. But hey, wait a minute. I mean, you know, it's 72 hours. You're going to hold a person for 72 hours. If you ain't got the evidence, he's got to get out of there.
I mean, look, every episode on TV show is like, you've got to race to get evidence or
you've
got to get away.
You got to go race to get, we've got to let him go.
This is far beyond that. This is complete criminality.
Right, this is criminality.
Old Southern racism. And this, you can tell, it isn't just racism. It's so old school here. This is like old Dixie. This is a little fiefdom that's run by his private, you know, little kingdom that he lords over. He does anything he wants, his relatives do anything they want, and everybody in that town and community, just like David said earlier, is terrified of him. That's what's going on. It's a dictatorship of you know, racism and hatred there. But they don't care about the law. They don't care about the Constitution.
Now,
that's obvious.
Tell us something, Dave, because Elizabeth is not here, but tell us what she said. Didn't she told by the jailer that you're not going to be able to see him again, so don't bother to come back here?
Yeah, that's what the Captain Gill, okay, at Franklin County Jail told her, that you're not going to be allowed to see yourself, so don't bother yourself to come down here, okay? And then plus on the phone, when she called on Tuesday, someone told her, the official was unidentified, but they told her that he didn't think, the person said to themselves, that I don't think this man is allowed to see anyone. Why? Why is this young man allowed to see anyone?
Exactly.
You know, if he hasn't violated any crimes, and I don't see how he could have violated any rules or anything, because he's been locked up in a cell, 9x6 cell by himself for over a year. So what rules has he broken? You know, and it's just like Thomas just described. This sheriff, Jerry Jones, is running his own little dictatorship. Okay, it's his jail, Shannon's housed in his jail, and he's given these people the instructions to keep this young man housed in these conditions.
When you told me the story about her having to go with the Superior Court Judge, Hobgood, up there, and that this judge had to stand there and repeatedly ask, and then make the demand that I'm not leaving the building until I see him, to even get the door open to let this prisoner have a visitor, you know that's illegal. You know everything you need to know right there. If even a judge is having to go in there, and he wouldn't go unless he probably already knew he would have to go. But if he has to go and stand in a courthouse refusing to leave until they comply with the law, are you kidding me? I mean, everything about this case is wrong, wrong, wrong.
I mean, you know, Charles Manson has more rights than this young man does. He's interviewed all the time.
Charlie's got girlfriends, and
right,
you know, they debated letting him get married. Just
I don't want to say this. Since he's not a terrorist, or else he'd be in the real Guantanamo Bay.
Hey, even in Guantanamo, they got more rights than this.
That's
They get visitors, too. So this is ridiculous. No,
all right,
ridiculous.
Tell us some of the things. We were supposed to have a couple of more guests on the show. Have you heard from them, David?
No, I haven't heard from anyone.
Okay.
Well, here's a question. Speaking of, let's lift it up a bit. In January, I saw where we had Reverend Al Sharpton and his network said they were getting involved. They were looking into the case. You know, That's what we need. We need a national spotlight shining like the sun down here and let all these cockroaches run for cover. But what's happening on those fronts? Do we have anything happening that we know?
Is anything happening with the National Action Network?
Well, actually, we have been on a number of podcasts and actually live radio in the Charlotte area and other areas within the state of North Carolina. Unfortunately, the problem is that not enough people know about this case, and that's the strongest thing that we're trying to do is promote as much advocacy as we can for Shannon Imhotyi and any other defendant that's been held in these kinds of conditions down there in Franklin County or any other jurisdiction in the state of North Carolina. And at this point, that's what we're continuously trying to do. We're just trying to continue to advocate for Shannon and, you know, spread the word as much as possible. Now, I do know that there's been a push now to get a number of local and national media affiliates, newspapers and radio stations and television stations to promote this case. In fact, I will be meeting with someone on Tuesday, Monday or Tuesday of next week from the Amsterdam News up in Harlem, New York, regarding Shannon Imhotyi's case. So that's the strongest, that's the only thing that we can do right now. NAN is on the ground. NAN is boots on the ground. They're continuously spreading the word, contacting various news affiliates to try to get this word out there. So NAN is actively, probably the only group that is actively pushing to get this young man's story out to the public.
And tell us what happened when the NAACP was asked.
Well, first of all, I don't even like to mention that phrase. I don't even like to mention that term, NAACP, because it's a joke, okay? Uh-huh. When Beth Crudup initially went to the person who was the chair of her of the NAACP in Franklin County, he told her that he wasn't going to go after a young black boy in jail because he's got to live around there. So, again, he's afraid himself. You have the officials of the NAACP who are afraid to do something down there. And this just only demonstrates how much power this one sheriff, this one law enforcement official has down there, okay? And then also Dr. Barber, who I know you know personally, Michael, who's actually the state chair for the North Carolina Conference of the NAACP, told her, we simply just don't do that. What do you mean you just don't simply do that? All of the people, historically, the NAACP has gotten people out of prison and advocated for people who have been wrongly accused and charged with crimes. I mean, they've actually paid hired lawyers to defend these people. So, again, I don't know, you know, what's going on in North Carolina with the NAACP, but right now, in my mind, they're not even a factor.
Yeah, but you have to give them this. I understand that they're being weak. But there's also fact behind the weakness. And the fact is we've got a horribly corrupt, at the very least, corrupt and illegal county going on. But there's probably very real violence and threat of violence behind it. I mean, we got this like this one, you know, these two brothers, the Chalk brothers, running around terrorizing this community. How many lists of gun violations, robberies, beatings, everything else that they're involved in, just them alone, and yet they're never in jail, you know. So there's obviously real stuff. And I want to remind you, you know, I'm from Mississippi. It wasn't, you know, that's enough of a joke right there. But even recently, they had to have federal government come in. It's 2010, 2011, then down there, they had to go in and investigate because down there, they had a policy of when you lock up the black kids in jail, and don't have enough evidence to really accuse them of anything, they all hang themselves with their shoestring or their toothbrushes
or
their comb or something like that. And there were so many suicides down there that the federal government came in and found that it was criminal. And so they went in and investigated, shut it all down, and then suddenly we went from, you know, 30 a year to 9. You know, how did that happen? Whoops. But so there's usually a fact behind the fear. It's not just that they're incompetent or not doing their job or not standing up. These people are probably truly scared for their life.
And the fact is that in the last 2 years, and I don't know how long it's been going on down there in Franklin County.
It's been going on long enough they've got mass-produced sheets
right.
and a process for disappearing people. So,
right.
What do you know?
But you see, a lot more is coming to light here in North Carolina in the last 2 years since this corrupt government was taken over by the billionaire Art Pope, because McCrory, who's supposed to be the governor, is not really the governor. Art Pope is actually running the state. And if the people don't know who Art Pope is, Art Pope is one who owns all those little, like Top Family Dollar, that was called, one of the little stores like that. They've got thousands of them, and they're all in poor neighborhoods. What's that name?
That's just ambient noise.
Oh, ambient. No. Okay. Yeah. Well, anyway, the thing is that the Art Pope is like the Koch brothers, except he is one Koch brother.
Yeah.
So
the Pope brother.
The Pope brother, right. And they are running. They helped McCrory become governor. And, of course, since they did, McCrory had to put them as part of the budget for the whole entire state. So they're the ones that are cutting the budget. And these other guys you see in the House, they just the puppets on the
floor. Yeah. Well, again, you got the systemic breakdown across the board of oversight, regulation, enforcement, everything else. But it leads to problems like this. Instead of this being impossible, Franklin County becomes possible. And that's the horror. Because as Miss Mary said earlier, and all, it's not just this poor child. If this case stands, there'll be 100 more. You know, there are going to be other people to support. And just like we're noticing with the paperwork, this has happened before. This is the process. The clerks say this is what we do. I mean, so when they're saying that, they've done it before. They're going to continue.
And they have no shame saying
until
it.
Until they get stopped, and we've got to stop them.
Yes.
We need that national spotlight.
David, tell us about the all the paperwork burning up.
Yeah, well, that's a highly publicized case down there. Probably that's the biggest story down in Franklin County now is these 160-year-old records that were destroyed. Once the new clerk got elected, she discovered a trove of archive records in the basement of the Franklin County Courthouse. And, you know, they were trying to sort it out, and she was overwhelmed. She didn't know what to do with it, so they contacted the state archives. The state archives came in and told about, okay, well, you know, you just stop. We'll handle it. They took over, and then one night, under the cover of darkness, they showed up with the sheriff and took every file out of the courthouse and took it over to the city, the town's incinerator, and burnt it. Okay? So you got a lot of records, you know, a lot of dirt.
David, you're telling me that the state people came down, the archive people, and went with the sheriff over to the courthouse and took out all the records?
Yes, sir. There's a volume of newspaper articles out there on it. That's exactly what happened.
And it's the same sheriff, correct?
Well, that's the sheriff's town. It's the sheriff's town. It's Franklin County. It's Jerry Jones territory.
Now, the state archive, that is now run by the Republican Party.
Okay.
So there are a lot of things, then, what you're saying is that they had things in that archive that they did not want the new state auditor to find out about.
Apparently so. Well, you know, Michael, back during, right after the Civil War, you know that, you know, a lot of landowners down there incurred a volume of problems because there were high taxes that they now had to pay, and they could no longer afford the lifestyle that they had previously lived. You know, so they were selling the property, and you had a lot of northerners who came down and, you know, kind of like swindled them out of them. They got the properties on a penny on the dollar, and that's where the term carpetbagger came from. Okay? And then, you know, a lot of the property owners, you know, instead of, you know, selling out to them, they figured they'd give the money, they'd give the property and stuff to the slaves, the former slaves who had worked it, because they figured they would do better. They would properly cultivate the land and everything. In a lot of those cases, they were either threatened and other all kinds of illegal activity was done to force those individuals, the former slaves, to turn over the property, you know, to these folks up north. And they became some of the richest people in the South. Okay, now I believe that there are political factions now in existence who are aware of the paperwork trail, okay, that points to that, you know, and that's why those documents were destroyed. And then also, you know, the number of criminal cases. You know, a lot of these court cases that they may have put in archives, people who are locked up, who may be down there locked up like Shannon is, you know, that's all gone now. You know, this stuff was ordered. They came in, the state archives came in with the sheriff, and they destroyed this stuff.
So you got to wonder why and who, and how do they, because they use law enforcement to do it. So who ordered that?
The rationalization that they gave was that the documents were their retention had expired, you know. And you know, I mean, yeah, because you know, the state or whatever state law is, you know, there's a retention, you know, for a certain document or what have you. But it's you know, I just can't understand. Standing there with a 100-year-old, you're talking about a 160-year-old document. Who destroys that? I don't care what it is. Who destroys a 160-year-old document? I don't care if it's retention has expired or whatever.
Well, we're missing the point. It doesn't have to be the 160-year-old document. It's a document or documents in those files that they didn't want to find.
Well, and the other thing is the find, the trove, if you read the article, was found when they were doing renovation in a bricked-up room.
Mm-hmm.
So it was sealed. See, and so you don't know what all was put on there and when it was sealed. So it's from 160 years on up.
I mean,
so you know, there very seriously could be some ramifications to friends and family members of.
This
you know.
Has got to be a movie. I mean, I'm going to speak to my cousin who just finished her first film, and I'm going to because I'm telling you, the cast of characters in here.
Like in the heat of
Matthew McConaughey to come in and play the defense lawyer that comes in that rescues Shannon.
It'd be the John Grisham
right and,
lawyer.
Well, we can get let's see, is that clown Andrea Jolie's daddy to be the sheriff. I can see it all playing out here. This is a movie because who the hell would believe this? Just by you telling it to someone.
Right.
I mean,
well, it sounds so outlandish. It's like that could never happen here. You know, we've got laws to protect against us.
You're right.
Everything has been violated top to bottom on the sports.
I mean, this is just outrageous. It is outrageous.
Well, it's unbelievable. So, have they searched? Do they have some teams going through to find the other drones? Another brick off area, the Franklin County Courthouse or the Sheriff's
now,
Office?
Is there...
Are there other bonfires going late at night? You might want to show up. I'm just saying. It's a disturbance.
David, can you tell me that...
I didn't hear you, Mike. I'm hearing ambient noise.
Yeah, hold on a minute. This is quiet now. Who's online? What happened when Elizabeth went down to see? She spoke to the clerk of court. Tell us that story.
She spoke to whom?
Spoke to the clerk of court, Elizabeth, and tell us that story. What happened when she spoke to the clerk of court, and then she went down there?
Yeah, well, she spoke to the clerk of court. She had told them, first of all, you have to back up, because she actually spoke to the DA, Sam Curran, okay? And he told her that, because she questioned the missing paperwork and why certain documents weren't there, and while she talked to him about that search warrant affidavit for Facebook. And he said, well, you know, the clerk of court, they're slow. They're not adequate there. They take a long time to do, you know, for things to get processed. But she said to him, she said, Mr. Curran, but I'm talking about a document from November of 2012. It took the clerk of court 2 years to get this in there? And then he starts yelling at her, do you know your son's charged with a crime of killing someone, almost killing someone? Do you know that? So he tried to intimidate her. So she says, well, Mr. Curran, that still has nothing to do with why these documents suddenly reappeared in the file. You know, and so, you know, to make a long story short, he put it on the clerk of courts. So she called him, told him what he said, and she said, Miss Crudup, you will come by here, okay? And we're going to sit down and we're going to go through every document in that file. All right, and that's essentially what they did. And when he came across the search warrant affidavit, and let me tell you, you know, just let your listening audience know the significance of that. Now, once they obtained the search warrant for the Facebook pages, he made his discovery. He actually obtained the search warrant on August 27th of 2012 and conducted the search the same day. Now, he never filed that document with the County Clerk's Office for Superior Court until 90 days later. 90 days later, 3 months later.
90 days. Then add, subtract, multiply, divide, anything you wanted onto that document in 90 days that you might.
No. Let me tell you this, Michael. I'm Thomas. Now, what he did, the guy was very proactive about what he did. Now, I still haven't figured out why he did what he did because, you know, given the significance of that document, because it dismisses the entire conspiracy theory that Shannon had communicated with this boy about a shotgun and a girl to conspire to kill her mother. Shannon, there were no records found, is what the document stated. No records found and no records were seized. And in the essay area where you would put where the items were discovered, he took the proactive measure to draw big long lines through all of that area on two separate pages. Okay, and as a former law enforcement officer, I know what he was doing. You know, he's experienced. It shows his level of experience. It shows that, you know, he's probably experienced someone, you know, altering his document in the past once he had already submitted it. Now, by doing that, it prohibited anyone from altering that document, okay? And it made certain that his actual findings would be, you know, truly represented in that document. You know, now, he may have waited 90 days because he knew what was going on, what they were trying to do to the kid, and he just waited till all the smoke and steam had gotten out of the story, and then he turned it in to make sure that it was in the file. Now, when Beth Crudup initially went down there, that document was never in the file. You know, I started writing about, hey, this sheriff and this prosecutor need to be, you know, and that Sellers, the DA, they need to be prosecuted because there's no evidence in the file. You don't have a case in the file. You know you don't have a case, but you got the guy locked up, you know. That's illegal. You can't do that. So that's malicious prosecution. So I started writing about that. And then, like, the next week, the very next week after that blog article, okay, 150-so-odd pages mysteriously reappears in the file. Okay, and that document that we just talked about, that search warrant affidavit for Facebook for the victim's daughter and Shannon, okay, is very, very telling. Okay, they knew before he was even indicted that they really didn't have a strong case against this kid. Okay, because he discovered the findings on August 27th of 2012, and they indicted Shannon on October 4th of 2012. A whole week prior to his indictment, they knew that Shannon had not communicated with anybody pertaining to some kind of plot or theory to kill this woman.
David, you have done such a fabulous job. I want to tell you.
And, you know, you're going to end up sending this.
We didn't even get to the conspiracies yet. But, I was on the phone. We were on, like, a five-way call last night this afternoon for a long time. I mean, 2 hours, I thought. And we kept getting disconnected and everything. And tell us what you think. Do you know what Elizabeth is doing today? Because she was going to be on the call.
No, I'm actually going to call on her. I try to monitor her movement. I know that every time she travels down there, she's with someone. She takes appropriate measures at my behest for her personal safety. So I'm a little alarmed that she did not call into the show today. That will be the first thing that I'm doing after this broadcast to try and find out if I can catch up with her to ensure her safety, her personal safety. But what you were talking about, Michael, there's been some strange things occurring on the phone. And I have also encouraged her to just simply get another phone. One night we were on the phone discussing the case. We were going over documents. Actually, when the chief discovered these 100 or so odd pages that had suddenly reemerged in a file, we were going over that on the phone. And then someone came on, and it was like a gasping sound, like someone was choking. You know, and it went on and on and on. I couldn't hear her, and I kept saying, hello, hello, hello. And then shortly after that, I started hearing these sounds like from the Twilight Zone. You know, and then eventually, you know, I just hung up. You know, and then I called her back. We established communication back again. And she said, did you hear that? I said, yeah. She said, what is going on with that? I said, I don't know. So I dismissed it as maybe some kind of technical glitch in the phone line. But on yesterday, Beth Krug was actually on a podcast, live interview on the podcast, and the exact same thing happened during the broadcast. And she heard it, and the host and the co-host heard it. And that's what we were talking about on the phone last night, Michael. You know, and then as you very well know, Michael, yesterday, because you were there, you know, we were bumped off. All five calls were bumped off about four or five times. You know, and every time we start talking about the state bill of investigations or the state prosecutor's office, these kinds of things that the phones were carrying. You know, now you weren't talking about a conspiracy theory, Michael. That's a conspiracy theory for you right there, brother.
Absolutely. And I want to say that this phone trouble happens all the time. I'm a Cointelpro target, and I'm afraid that Elizabeth Crudup has become a Cointelpro target. And the thing is that whether it's coming from the feds or whether it's coming from the local police, it's much like the COINTELPRO. And with me, I'm very concerned about Shannon Nairobi because my brother was secretly arrested and murdered in Memphis Shelby County Jail in 2003. And we have never been given any records about who arrested him, why he was arrested, why he was in custody, and how he died. They refused. Instead of giving us the records, instead of explaining how a man was secretly arrested, kept for 18 days while they lied and said he wasn't in custody, and then when he died, they came to the house and said, he's dead, we had him the whole while. A man who had missing person reports out on him, and he was a mentally ill heart patient. He's supposed to be a protected class. He's a black person. They killed him and will not tell us how or why he died. So this thing that's going on has been happening.
So this took place in Shelby, North Carolina?
This took place in Shelby County, Memphis, Tennessee.
Oh, Memphis, Tennessee, okay.
Yes. And so I'm very concerned about Shannon because occasionally inmates die. And when they do die, they will simply refuse to give records as to how and why they died. In America. Yes, in America.
Yeah, I know all about that firsthand. You know, as a former correctional officer myself, I can tell you, once I found out that Shannon was being placed in segregation and there was no legitimate reason given for that particular housing class, I immediately became concerned for Shannon's safety because I know the kinds of things that can occur. And like Thomas had alluded to earlier about the cases down in Mississippi where people were being hanged, you find it all the time. You know, Memphis is not Mississippi is not only the only state where the Department of Justice have come in and you know, did an inquiry or an investigation about that kind of thing. You know, actually, in my home state of Maryland, Prince George's County Police Department, they have had more people die in custody. More detainees or prisoners die in custody. I'm not talking about a county jail or a state prison. I'm talking about just their lockup. Okay, they've had more people die in their custody than any other law enforcement agency in the history of the country. Okay, so I know very well what you're talking about, Murray, in terms of, you know, what strange things can happen behind those walls. You know, the public doesn't know what's going on back there. It's a different world back there. You know, and you got people. You know, you got people.
That goes back to a question that was asked earlier. What would make this woman, Rhonda, turn around on her story? They have her daughter in custody. They have probably issued threats about her daughter. We're going to lengthen her sentence. We're going to harm her. It's probably not a situation where she's expecting to come back with a lawsuit against Shannon. I think that as a mother, even though this daughter tried to have her killed, she still lost her child. And I think that since the state of North Carolina has that girl in custody, she has been threatened and bullied about her version of what happened. That's what I think is happening.
Wow, that's a very plausible scenario. That is very plausible.
You know what? And maybe we're going at this the wrong way. Maybe we should try to find out where the daughter is.
Well, see, again, she's a minor. I don't know how.
Well, this is the problem. I think that if she's in jail, but they would dare put her in jail, would they?
Well, she'll be in like a juvenile hall or something protected. Not a full jail. But, David, so.
I want you to know that kids die in juvenile halls. Kids are killed in juvenile halls. I just finished writing a story last year about a girl who they put in isolation. They have isolation in juvenile hall, and they also killed them in juvenile hall. Yes, they did. So juvenile hall is still jail. It's still prison. They can lock up a girl in the cell with girls who are in a gang and what have you. They can make things happen to children, and it has already been done.
Yeah. Here's a question about, we've got mysterious goings-ons. We've got files that are appearing and disappearing, bugged phones, things of this nature. Why don't we take, you talked about her going up there being accompanied, at least so she'll be safe, but are y'all taking proactive measures on all of this, like documenting everything, recording every file, every email, everything that you can before they're deleted or altered, taking, photographs of the files while you're there?
She's done that. The mother has gotten a lot of these documents and actually took photographs of the ones they couldn't allow her to copy or what have you. She's actually taking photographs. So everything that's in the file, the last time that she visited, which was like 2 weeks ago, we do have a copy of it. We have a copy of it. But as we just, discussed previously, Thomas, there are a number of things missing. Like the DNA test results. Why would you issue DNA for a criminal defendant and, not do it, not follow through and actually send it to the lab, So I know that those results have got to exist somewhere, but they're just not in the file at the county clerk's office, the fingerprinting, And then there was a report in there that indicated that there was no fingerprints of Shannon or any DNA on the weapon itself that they're saying was the murder, was the assault weapon or what have you. Those records are not in the file. So, everything that is in the file that's available, Beth Crudup has gotten a copy of it. To just reiterate her personal safety, I actually encouraged her to file a criminal complaint with the Federal Bureau of Investigations, which she did probably back in January. There is an active file with the FBI that was confirmed through her for her son's case in Franklin County. So we have done just about everything that we can do to ensure, number one, her personal safety, and to make certain that the documents in the case have been retained, that we at least have a copy of it. Because as you very well hinted to, alluded to, Thomas, those files can mysteriously disappear. So I'm glad that she was very proactive about retaining those particular documents.
Did you have a copy of all this?
Yes, I do. I have a copy of every record that she has.
Okay.
Well, here's another thing I'm just going to say real quick because we're running out of time. These days, they have fantastic devices. They have fantastic programmers that can do everything just like governments can to trace viruses and bugs and intrusion and illegal hacking. Y'all can hire a detective agency to sweep those homes, computers, everything else, see if they've been hacked, see if they've been recorded. You can get, see where they've been hacked from, all that kind of stuff. You can get that at least documented that has been occurring. See if her accounts have been, accessed from outside. because y'all are having very mysterious things go on. And it doesn't necessarily have to be, you know, sweep the phones for bugs type thing. Nowadays, you can cyber hack things from a distance. But something's going on. But I would try to get as much evidence as humanly possible. And if you can, you know, Freedom of Information Acts against them. Try to get everything released that you can. All of their files. Why, you know, I would just try to amass a mountain of evidence because it helps prove or disprove any kind of conspiracy or any kind of criminal activity going on.
Right. Yeah, I'll make sure that I let her know that.
I just want to say regarding laboratories that we have a laboratory, I think it's in Massachusetts, I'm not sure, where 180,000 cases are due for reexamination because the people who worked in the labs were working with the prosecutors to convict innocent individuals. So, you know, so often we say, where's the DNA evidence and where's the fingerprint evidence? And I just want you to know that these people in the justice system are working for money a lot of times, and they're working for money against justice. And so labs can lie also. 180,000 cases have to be revisited because the person in the lab was tainting evidence to work for the prosecutors, and also another woman who worked in the same lab was not educated to be a lab technician. She lied and said she graduated from Marinette College, and she did not. She did not have the authority to be working there.
Right.
Well, we've run out of time now, and Mary and David, you guys are on the case. Mary, you have sent me your information, correct?
Yes, I sent you an email.
Okay, good. And David, see if you can find out what happened to Mary and the other two gentlemen, Alfonso and Robert.
Right,
I don't
right.
know what happened. And,
well, I'm online, Mary Loves Justice. You can find me online, and you can put Mary Loves Justice, Shannon Modi.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
Very good, Mary. I want to thank both of you for being here on the show, and we're going to do this again next week because we're not going to let this drop until everybody hears about it.
That's right. And for the listeners, just a reminder, David Adams' website,
right.
thepeopleschampion.me.
That's right, thepeopleschampion.me. And David, you have sent me a load of stuff with this, correct, David?
That's correct. Yes, I have. I've already sent it to you and the gentleman, Mr. Randy Voller, the NCDP. Pertaining to the case, all the files that I have, you guys both had it.
Okay, because I am going to be talking to my my cousin who actually did my website, and we're going to be posting that stuff on my website this weekend, so everybody can take a look at all these files, and you can see for yourself there is no evidence. And when they say, "Oh yeah, we got evidence," but it's just not in the file. For 2 years, is something wrong with the picture? I mean, they're much
right.
lies of the prescription drug companies. All right. Thank you, David. Thank you, Mary. We'll be talking to you next week.
Always a pleasure, Michael.
Okay.
Thank you very much, Michael. Thank you, everybody.
Right. Thank you. We got about 4 minutes, but I wanted to play something for everybody about what happened in the U.S. House yesterday, unprecedented. It's about our friend, Mr. The felon who's running the committee, the Oversight Committee for the United States, the felon, the felon, David Issa. This is what happened because he is now really pissed off the Democratic Party.
Whereas Ranking Member Cummings protested immediately, stating, quote, "Mr. Chairman, you cannot run a committee like this. You just cannot."
Well, gentlemen will suspend. Chair is going to ask for the decorum of the House that members not display their iPads. violation of the House rules.
Here's the other end of that.
Chairman Issa's abusive behavior on March 5th is part of a continuing pattern in which he has routinely excluded members of the committee from investigative meetings, has turned on members' microphones when they were questioning a witness. Now, therefore, be it resolved that the House of Representatives strongly condemns the offensive and disrespectful manner in which Chairman Darrell E. Issa conducted the hearing of the House Committee on Oversight and Government Reform on March 5, 2014, and requires that he come to the well of the House to issue a public apology to the members of the House.
That's about time.
So Issa is in deep doo-doo, as we say.
Yep.
He cut off the mic of Representative Cummings, who is the minority chair of the Oversight Committee. But this is not very time.
That was just the latest.
That was the latest.
He's done this before.
Yeah.
This is the guy who went in saying that he was going to take Obama out with an investigation every day of his presidency.
Absolutely right. And this before, this is just the same day when the president got elected. So here's the thing. Darrell Issa, who is a convicted felon and shouldn't be allowed to even be in politics, as far as I'm concerned, because he was stealing when he was in the military, but they couldn't prove it. So now the problem with him, why he cut off Cummings, is because that he knows that Miss Lerner, who was the head of the department that supposedly scrutinized conservative 501c3s, says she would testify, but she needs another week. He did not want to hear anything that she said because it would throw everything back in his face. He has not called the head of the department, who is a lifelong Republican, who has said in documents that he's the one who created this level of scrutiny. And he just wasn't doing it with the conservative 501c3s. He was doing it with the Democratic 501c3s. So I want everybody to have a great weekend. We got to get out of here now. And I'm going to leave you with one of my favorite songs. Just listen. To everybody out there, you know what I mean.